With a face like that, you still manage to do very well. Thank you, Les. I'm only kidding. That's the best in real country music, too, by Lester Nearle and all the boys.
And there you are, an end to that old twang and swang from Troublesome Thomas Equality Leavitt, who's, yes, his middle name is really Equality. Boy, I can't make any caustic comments about Thomas today because he's caught up with all his work with the Huff website. We better get you going again, Thomas, obviously. Thomas is actually a guy who's been working for a decade and more than a decade on civil rights issues around poor and homeless people, as I have, and he's provided a lot of graphics, he's provided buttons. I'm still waiting for the Santa Cruz 11 button, Thomas. I want something flashy, something exciting, if you don't mind. We'll see where that goes. We're having really slow computer times here in the studio today, so it may be a kind of a long slog. But I have a lot of clippings I brought with me, which I hope to pull out. I almost never am able to do that. I always bring a shitload of clippings, but then don't do any reading on the air. I usually get lost in other stuff. But I don't have too many interviews today, if any, so it may be clipping time. And so that's a possibility. There's also going to be reading some correspondence I've gotten from Doug Loisel, Linda Lemaster. There's an article in today's Urinal, also known as the Sentinel, about the get all the homeless out of town, they're murderers approach, or I should say regulate them far more closely to keep an eye on all those sinister characters proposed by Coonerty Council people. Coonerty is the vice mayor, or actually he was the mayor, now he's a council member. And it was pushed by the Sentinel, and it's kind of the Take Back Santa Cruz type agenda. That's an organization that's been fighting to demonize homeless people for at least 2 or 3 years, run by the Cubes, Annalisa and Dexter Cube. And they've gotten a number of appointees, different city government bodies. I don't know if that's translated into an anti-homeless agenda per se, but it looks like Hillary Bryant is leading the way with Coonerty and Lynn Robinson around homeless lack of service center cutbacks. Not that I'm a big fan of the center, but the specific proposals are pretty nasty. So I may have some discussion of that coming up. It's a frequent deal. That has been happening in the last couple of weeks, a frequent concern of a lot of people. I've been trying to kind of poo-poo it with a suggestion that it's, well, your usual homelessophobia hysteria, but and also the politicians are kind of impervious both to the right and the left in this town. So I suppose there is that either to be thankful for or to at least note when these things come up. But again, it's not really the politicians we have to worry about. It's the community and whether they buy this bullshit that's being slung around by the NIMBY bigots who are always around. I mean, they're always there, unfortunately. It's I don't know. It's like having the nigger haters, you know. It's like having the misogynists. It's a sickness in our society that all of us have. I mean, we're just not brought up to view each other in a way that's mutually supportive and where we can actually substitute real security for frenzied control measures that masquerade as security. So let's let's take a brief musical beginning here and see where we're at. See if I've got anything exciting. Yeah, some interesting stuff. I don't know how interesting this is, but might be worth a hoot. Let's give it a try.
What's that spell?
Seven.
What's that spell? So put down your book, pick up a gun. I'm gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, a two, a three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Fly, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. Well, come on, General, let's move fast. The old big chance has come at last. Gotta go out, get those reds. The only good commie is the one that's dead. And you know the peace can only be won when the golden rule of the kingdom come. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. Boys up to Vietnam. Come on, fathers, don't hesitate. Send them off before it's too late. Be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
Of course, was Country Joe and the Fish, and I remember that one for long ago. Of course, Vietnam has been able to throw off the American yoke, and now they're just yoking it up over in Afghanistan, Yemen, Sudan, Iraq, and of course Pakistan. But to name only a few, the most obvious places, it's continued warfare everywhere at your expense, while the sideshow of the election cavalcades on. But having said that, let's move on to more relevant matters of sort of the ongoing disaster that you are in the middle of, but that it's kind of hard to do something about, but efforts are much appreciated. Santa Cruz efforts have resulted in fighting the war and in fighting banksters and in fighting police abuse and trying to establish what I guess some called the reestablish the power of the 99%. There's been repression against the Occupy movement and against other activists, and which I've talked about endlessly on this show and will continue to talk about. It's important that we not just talk about it, that we do something about it, which is even harder. But it's not just happening here, it's happening in other cities. And I was checking out yesterday the East Bay Indie Media. That's the indybay.org/East Bay, for those of you who want to go there. And that is a website that has a lot of stuff happening up there, and a lot of particular events have been happening around the Oakland police and court system's response to just ordinary community activism criticism. I'm going to begin with an interview with Kate Hallinan, probably of the Hallinan clan up there, the famous kind of family of attorneys, which concerns a fellow who was picked up by cops a few days ago, Chris Moreland of Occupy Oakland's Tactical Action Committee. According to this report, he was repeatedly targeted by police for his outspokenness on issues of economic injustices. He's helped organize numerous actions around foreclosures and homelessness in Oakland. At a community meeting called by Mayor Gene Kwan and the OPD, the Oakland Police Department, to address the recent police murder of high school senior Alan Bluford, Chris was equally outspoken as he confronted Police Chief Howard Jordan about the killing. Oakland police did not arrest Chris at the Acts Full Gospel Church, where the public meeting was held, choosing instead to wait until Chris had left the church, swarming in on him at the nearby BART station. Chris was charged with felony battery on a police officer, amongst other things, sent to Santa Rita, and his bail was set at over $100,000. And then on Friday, the district attorney's office validated the charges had no merit by declining to pursue anything other than a misdemeanor disturbing the peace charge. Chris's bail then became $2,500, which solitary activists have already posted. And this is kind of hauntingly familiar. The same thing happened to Gabriella Ripley Phipps and a number of other activists, five or six of them, way back in December 8th when police were goose-stepping through the former Occupy Santa Cruz homeless campground in San Lorenzo Park, destroying property, clearing people away from the public space, and creating 100 to 200 homeless refugees. Gabrielle was one of the people who was trying to document and help people there. She was arrested, not in the midst of doing anything in particular, but just afterwards snatched, taken to jail, held on, I guess it was $50,000 bail, or was it $25,000? One of the two. Huge amount of money, which the next day was reduced to nothing. And all those charges were dropped. Although one of them, a misdemeanor charge, may have reappeared, because she has now been recharged as one of the Santa Cruz 11, who supposedly were instrumental in felony vandalism and felony conspiracy at the conspiracy to commit journalism and expose Wells Fargo Bank and possibly to set up a community center. Although, again, six of the 11 have already had charges against them dismissed by the judge. But that's not good enough for the DA. She's refiled against two of them. DA Rebecca Young, who's the underling for DA Bob Lee, who's the primary DA in Santa Cruz County, the elected DA. So in Oakland, the same kind of thing is happening. Police are using the climate of fear and repression and hysteria and mainstream media support for this kind of police action to go after people who are raising legitimate and important questions in a loud and effective manner in the community in ways that empower others and encourage others to do the same, as occupies throughout the country we're doing. I'm going to play now, assuming this computer works, the interview with Kate Hallinan. She can describe what went down, and there'll be some other. I'm going to play some more from this situation if it sounds airworthy and interesting. And in case you're interested, you are tuned to 101.3 FM. I failed to announce that at the beginning of the show. This is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. I'm Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norris, and I do a show twice a week. This is the longer one, goes on till 1 o'clock, unless I poop out early, which is always a possibility. And you're invited to call in, but there's only one phone line today, 427-3772, 831-427-3772. You can also call me off air if you wish to leave me a secret message or just say something you don't particularly want to put on the immediately out over the air. That's 831-423-4833. That's the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom line, a civil rights organization concerned with restoring or perhaps creating for the first time rights for homeless people and put folks outside that are currently being denied them, and increasingly they're being treated as a scapegoating group, sort of the modern-day Jews, so to speak, or Negras, or Chinese, or whatever you will. Anyway, here's an interview with Kate Hallinan. It's short, and I hope it comes through. Let's see if we can do it. Uh, It's booting up, so let's cross our fingers. Free Chris, interview with attorney Kate Hallinan, May 25th, 2012, is what the screen reads. There's also a video as well as a audio, but I think the audio portion is probably...
Hi, so it looks like Chris will be out tonight.
They lowered the bail to $2,500, so that'll allow him to get out with posting $250, so I don't think it would be too much to be out tonight.
That's a big change from the $100,000 plus bail he had previously.
It is. Well, the $100,000 bail was based on charges that the police arrested him for. No DA or court had actually reviewed those charges, and frankly, they were ludicrous, and they were not based on anything that had actually happened, as numerous witnesses have attested to. And so the very fact that the DA did not bring those charges is evidence of the fact that they had absolutely no proof that he did anything like assault. To go from assault with a deadly weapon to disturbing the peace shows that the arrest was entirely essentially based on fabricated evidence.
So essentially it's an abuse of the system in that they can hold him in jail with a bail so high that it's hard to post the bond.
Without question. And it's definitely a targeted effort against Chris in particular. The Oakland Police Department and the court system is focused very much on Chris, and this was very much an attempt to get him off the street.
Just to send a message that if you yell at us at an Alan Buford press conference or whatever that was, we'll come after you.
Exactly. There's something called freedom of speech, but that doesn't include speaking truth to the police.
Yeah. If you yell at them, they're gonna show you.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so the DA was throwing out some more scurrilous kinds of arguments as to why he shouldn't be released on his own recognizance. Do you care to comment on any of that?
Well, I think it was if not improper, it was inappropriate for her to bring up all of these accusations against him that they arrested him on. Considering the fact that the DA's office, her office, had chosen not to press any of those charges against him. And the only reason why, if he had actually assaulted an officer, if he had actually committed great bodily injury as he was arrested for, there is no question that the DA's office would have charged him with those crimes. And so the fact that they didn't show that there was absolutely no evidence, and so for her to bring it up was at minimum inappropriate.
Yeah, just sort of slander almost at this point.
It is. And it's unfortunate that, you know, someone can be arrested, someone can be accused of something, and that remains on their record, and courts will look at that, DAs will bring that up, even though the system, you know, has adjudicated that person innocent or has, you know, dismissed the charges and not brought them because there wasn't sufficient evidence.
Right, there's no merit, but it'll follow him.
There's no merit, but it will follow him.
Yeah.
And that's true for everybody. If you're arrested, it's going to stay on your record.
That's unfortunate. Can you just tell me just a little bit about yourself and how you came to represent Chris?
Sure. My name's Kate Hallinan. I'm a criminal defense attorney with Pier 5 Law Offices. And I'm a member of Occupy Legal and the National Lawyers Guild. And so I have just taken various cases. Chris's original case happened to be one of them, the first Occupy arrest that he had. And I've continued to represent him throughout his subsequent Occupy arrest. So that's why I'm here today.
Great. Well, thank you for the work that you do.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you to everybody who's here.
It was a great turnout. The courtroom
really
was overflow.
It really was. It was just, it shows what an important person Chris is to the movement, and it's really evidence of why the police are targeting him so much, because he has a lot of followers who are there and supporters who are willing to listen to him because they know that, you know, he speaks truth to power, and that's what this really was about today, was him speaking truth to power.
Trying to get him to shut up, in effect.
Yeah, exactly.
But somehow I suspect that he's not going to.
I suspect that too. I suspect I might be here again, but I'm not.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
And that was Kate Hallinan defending Chris Moreland, who apparently has been released from jail, I believe, in Oakland, who's challenged Police Chief Jordan at a community meeting around the issue of the police killing of another member of the community, a young African-American guy, Alan Bluford. And I'm going to be playing some of that meeting. Here first, however, is an interview with Layla of Occupy Oakland. That's right, Occupy Oakland's Anti-Repression Committee. Actually, Occupy Oakland's Anti-Repression Committee outside the courthouse. And again, what's interesting is this same Pier 5 group, which Kate Hallinan is with, National Lawyers Guild, Tony Serra, actually, I think is the kingpin in that particular San Francisco office of attorneys. Alexis Briggs is representing one of the clients down here, Cameron Laurendeau, who I met, actually, probably met him before, but I really met him for the first time in the outside the court corridors in Santa Cruz. He's one of the Santa Cruz 11, and he is being recharged with felony vandalism, felony conspiracy to commit vandalism, felony conspiracy to trespass, and two counts of trespass for a peaceful protest that ended with no arrests at that time inside a vacant Wells Fargo-leased bank that's at 75 River Street. And this is the Layla of Occupy Oakland's Anti-Repression Committee, May 12th.
And what are you doing here?
Well, I'm here with many members of Occupy Oakland. We're here because one of our comrades, Chris, was arrested on Wednesday. And probably a lot of people saw the footage. There was essentially, many of us went to a church where Howard Jordan was speaking about the recent murder of Alan Bluford, a young man here in Oakland that was shot down by the police. And the police have changed their story several times. It turned out that, in fact, he wasn't armed as they always claim. One of the officers shot himself in the foot. So many members of the community had gone there to kind of to get some answers and felt very disrespected by the way the dialogue with the community went down. And I think it's important to note that one of the ways that meeting was structured was that no one was allowed to speak. None of us, no one in the community was actually allowed to utter in their own voice any of their questions. Everything had to be pretty written on index cards. And so even within kind of the structure of that dialogue was this kind of taking our voices away from us. And so many people stood up in that church and turned their backs in protest. And Howard Jordan continued to kind of spew lies about what had happened and refused to answer many of the community's questions. And Chris was quite vocal in that church, and I think it's important that he was, and for a number of reasons. One, because the structure of that community dialogue was set up to stop us from speaking. But two, also as a young black man, kind of without fear, and as a young black man who now has been snatched numerous times by OPD, to show that he's not afraid and he's going to continue to kind of speak truth to power. And for that reason, he was shortly after, he was snatched by OPD and arrested, not actually at the church, but later. They initially, the police filed really conflated charges, claiming that he had felony assault with a deadly weapon because of his megaphone was too loud in a police officer's ear. But basically threw a bunch of bogus charges in order to keep him in jail, and keep him in jail for the past 2 days with $100,000 bail. And today when we get to court, as usual, none of those charges actually can be filed by the district attorney's office because they're baseless. And so what they've done instead is to try and revoke his probation. And they're not even able to revoke his probation on the basis of this charge. There's not even enough basis for that. And so they're pulling something old on him. And so his attorney asked for OR today. We're all out here to support that. OR meaning for him to be released on his own recognizance. Since at the end, the only thing they've brought down is essentially a petition to revoke his probation for disturbing the peace. And so they've reduced now now the bail is $2,500. We're all here. We raised that bond, which, you know, for us is like a couple hundred bucks, which is nothing for us. And we raised it right here in the courtroom. We're on our way over to bond him out. And we have an event tonight in solidarity with him. And then many, many of us will be heading out to Santa Rita Jail to wait for him. And this kind of jail solidarity support is really, really important because, you know, the tactic of this kind of police targeting and harassment is to terrify us and to make us frightened to come out and to speak and to protest. And so every time one of us are targeted in this way, it's crucial that we all stand there, even if it seems like a waste of time for 100 people to stand in front of Santa Rita just, you know, to welcome one comrade. That's in fact what kind of nourishes our movement, and that every one of us knows that none of us stand alone, and that we're all going to be there every time they snatch one of us. So as you see, you know, people are dancing and people are happy because we know that Chris is going to be out tonight. And, you know, he's already spent two nights in jail for no reason and there shouldn't be another. So, yeah, I mean, that's why jail solidarity support is working. As long as we're doing things that are going to kind of incite the police to harass us, we got to keep doing the support on the side of it so that we can all be out here to be able to do this work.
Great. Thank you very much for your time and thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you. Thank Indy Media for actually giving us some accurate coverage. Thank you. Right on. Thank you.
And that was Layla of the Oakland Anti-Repression Committee, if I have that right. Outside the Oakland courthouse on Friday, as I said, the individual she was supporting, Chris Moreland, who was picked up for speaking out, essentially, at a meeting of Mayor Kwan and the Oakland PD trying to defend the police killing or police murder, as some see it, of high school senior Alan Bluford. And of course, it's obviously, I'm going to start playing more of these interviews from across the country because it shows me, and hopefully it shows you, listeners, what's really going on in Santa Cruz is not an isolated thing. It has nothing to do with the Wells Fargo Bank or the, you know, so-called vandalism or any, you know, or trespassing. That's not what it's about. It's about crushing a movement. It's about instilling fear across a community. It's about shutting up activists. That is what it's all about. And as long as we don't shut up, and I don't know if this is a game of winning or losing, but I think what we're trying to do is, obviously, if you shut up, you have to stop talking about the abuses that we have been gathering together to fight and change in the first place. And unless you're talking about it at a level and at a in so quiet a voice that nobody really has to pay any attention or do anything about it or even hear about it. And that it kind of is the obvious reality for me. And however wasteful of time and energy these prosecutions are for all of us, I think she is probably right, Layla of the Oakland Anti-Repression Committee, in saying that there has to be this kind of solidarity. I had thought in the past, because I've been arrested many times before and I never convicted in Santa Cruz of anything of any note, never in any kind of a jury trial of any sort, of any misdemeanors. I've been convicted of infraction crimes for singing in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz and things of that sort. Again, but all pretty much of a piece. Where authority decides it wants to crack down and uses the courts to falsely and inappropriately forward its agenda. But, of course, kind of we come to expect that. But I, in the past, when I had dealt with the situation, I had not seen these huge bails being used, generally, against myself and other activists who were raising issues of homelessness, issues of police misconduct in the community. Issues of criminal behavior or inappropriate behavior or abusive behavior by authorities of different kinds. But now it's happening because I think authorities are really determined to drive people apart, to smear some people as, quote, violent, because, you know, if you're charged with a crime, you must be violent. Or somehow you write something on a wall, you're violent. Of course, if this happens in other countries, it's considered free speech. In Santa Cruz, it's considered vandalism. And I've not really examined closely the what was written on inside the Wells Fargo Bank that is being vastly inflated as some kind of heinous vandalism. And I'm not saying it was really worth you know, I prefer to write lengthy tomes online myself. But other people have ways of expressing themselves that they need to do, or that if they do those things that way, it's really a sign or a symptom of something more important than that vandalism itself or that graffiti itself. I mean, vandalism is a nice word used by the SCPD, for example, and by the Santa Cruz City Council to describe erasable chalk on a downtown sidewalk, I mean, which is absurd. And if you're with a large enough, politically acceptable enough group, the police will ignore you. But, of course, if you are doing so as a lone activist, as Becky Johnson was doing, she wasn't a lone activist, she had a group of hufsters around her, you can get taken to jail on a $1,000 bail, which was the first time Johnson was arrested. And bail was actually heightened at the request of Mia Parquette and the police department. Parquette is a Parks and Rec employee who's notorious more recently for harassing small dogs and homeless people with a blower in front of the City Hall grounds, which she was doing back in Peace Camp 2010. In any case, it's important that this is happening everywhere and that we really look at it clearly, be supportive of those who are currently fighting this in other cities, and also supportive, of course, of our own. And I know that sounds a little bit like special pleading, since I'm one of the suckers that got caught up in all this. But it's still worthy of doing. Here is... here's the video from the Oakland Police Department town hall meeting where the angry residents confront Oakland Police Chief and run him out over lies about the Alan Bluford killing.
He was actually given CPR by our responding officers.
And I'll read what's on the screen, interrupting briefly. On May 6, 2010, high school senior Alan Bluford was gunned down by the Oakland Police in East Oakland.
Required by our policy. More than a minute. And he also he was transported within minutes to Highland Hospital.
Every time y'all guys have a homicide, the body is always left out there for hours. I've seen that a gang of times.
What's the name of the medic?
Police initially claimed, again, I'm reading from the screen, I think this is the police chief talking, but I'm not sure. It's an African-American guy with a bald head. I don't recognize him. I'm not an Oakland local. But the screen says, the police initially claimed they were in a shootout, and Alan Bluford shot a cop. Now evidence surfaced to show that that was a complete lie.
A gang of time for hours for the coroner to come fix the body.
He laughs.
The cop who killed Alan Bluford, the screen reads, shot himself in the foot as a way to cover up his mistake. Alan had no gun.
I don't have the exact time, but it was not within 4 hours. How many minutes elapsed between the CPR administered by the police at the scene and Alan Bluford's arrival at the hospital?
Oakland police refused to release the names of the officer who murdered Alan Bluford, reads the screen. And again, an African-American, I assume it's a police chief, is reading a series of 3x5 index cards as he stands before a group of people dressed in a coat and tie.
He was given CPR immediately by our officers. I don't have the exact times, but I know...
So he says he was given immediately given CPR. The community, again, I have to interrupt because this is part of the narrative on the screen. The community is outraged, so much so OPD called a town hall meeting at Acts Full Church with Police Chief Howard Jordan, and that's apparently who is speaking.
They did provide medical treatment to Mr. Bluford.
At the town hall, Chief Jordan refused to take questions from the floor. He would only answer pre-written questions.
Did Alan point gun at police?
No.
Yes.
No.
Why was the police so nervous that he shot himself? We're looking at that ourselves.
And the screen reads, as Chief Jordan kept blatantly lying, community members turned their backs to him. I should say that in Santa Cruz, Mayor Lane has declared it will not be acceptable in city council for you to turn your back on the city council as you speak. because that is inappropriate decorum. This is the kind of thing that the city has spent $100,000 on attorney's fees fighting me in court on when they had me arrested for a silent, brief, off-to-the-side mock Nazi salute after the police intimidated. That wasn't the police, actually. It was the mayor who intimidated two people from speaking, telling them they'd be arrested, actually having one removed from the quarters, from the chambers. My response was, don't act like a bunch of fascists. You're in by essentially a silent salute. That was made the basis of an arrest for me. I was arrested, taken to jail. The DA, of course, couldn't prosecute any charges on that. I wasn't guilty of anything other than exercising First Amendment rights. And now for 11 years, actually 10, and going to court finally this summer, we've gotten a court date from Judge White, at least for a status conference in San Jose in federal court. We will be challenging the city of Santa Cruz and the two mayors and essentially Don Lane and his policy of, sit down, put your hands in your lap, stand up, talk the way we tell you to, or else we'll threaten you with arrest or embarrass you in front of the community or cut off your mic or direct that you leave the city council meeting. Anyway, back to Chief Jordan before members of the community have turned their back on him. And raise their fists, I might add.
How does the first statement made by the policeman's spokeswoman, John Watson, turns out to be 100% false information that Allen was in a gun battle? I'm not sure if how that information came out. We know that a reporter, based on the information he spoke to as witnesses, did at some point say that Allen shot the officer. There's no evidence that that ever happened.
And at this time, there's still, again, about 20 or 30 people have an audience of 50 or 70 or 80 people, maybe, and I can't quite judge it too clearly, standing with their backs silently, with their fists raised in the air, their backs to the police chief, as he, has no explanation for the falsehoods of his department, claiming that the man who was shot dead by the police murdered, they say, Allen Bluford, their claim that he had a gun and he shot first. Again, this is such a tired tale that police have used. It's not going to be so easy to do that as cell phones spread, if people use their own video equipment to document what's going on. And that, of course, means other forms of repression have to be raised to stop people from raising these issues, for stop people from demanding justice from established institutions whose notion of justice is to find a scapegoat and proceed and to defend their own gang of thugs and killers.
We're pretty sure about that. Thank you.
Y'all lying about one thing, but not another thing. What's going on with that? Tell the truth about everything. Why y'all lying about one thing? What's the name of the officer?
Has there ever been a police shooting that was not justified
the
homicide?
Who were there?
Yes, there has.
When? Beverly?
Why has officers not been identified? When will we know? What about the complete history?
In California, there is a policeman's bill of rights which allows officers to keep their names from being revealed to the public. It's also true in Santa Cruz. Police officers don't have to live in Santa Cruz. They live elsewhere. So people who don't live in their community are supposedly given extra legal and lethal force powers over people in their community.
Officer status. So the officer, his name will be released at the appropriate time based on state law. I'm not allowed to discuss that at this point. What about the complete history? We're not in a position to disclose the officer's complete history. The officer is out of administrative duty.
Is he in Tahoe like Meserly was?
Yeah,
until Oakland erupted?
When will the public know about?
And that comment from the audience, will he be in Tahoe like Meserly was? Meserly was the officer who murdered Oscar Grant III a couple years ago in the BART station. Meserly was essentially given a slap on the wrist. He was sentenced to a brief period of time in jail. He was allowed to travel. He was released on bail. He was only because of the fact that it was documented so thoroughly that even charges were brought against him, in the opinion of many. But, of course, Oakland Police Chief Jordan ignores that and continues speaking.
Fingerprints, if any, found at the weapon that was recovered at the scene. That's information that we will share with the family later on as the investigation is concluded. Why was it considered necessary for chase of Mr. Bluford? The officers were investigating what they thought was drug and weapons violations, and they had a reason to investigate that.
Again, the screen has more information. In California, officers don't do stop and frisk. They jump out of cars, often unmarked and in plain clothes. This causes folks to run who fear they are being robbed.
My understanding, two officers were at the scene. One of them chased Bluford. Is it possible for the standard police procedure to pursue citizens suspected of committing crimes alone without having called for backup? The officer did what we trained him to do. He did call for backup, and the officer
did. He did. He killed. That's what you trained him to do.
Were any of your policies violated? We will be looking at that very closely, and we'll provide that information later on.
Jail Miguel Mazzo. Jail Miguel Mazzo.
Jail the killer cop.
Where is Miguel Mazzo? Young Miguel Mazzo was the killer.
They quit. You shoot a young brown brother or a young black brother.
We are here to answer questions from the community. It's very difficult to answer.
And now people are beginning, there's still a group of people, most people who are with, I said about a third of the room is standing with their fists raised, their backs to the sky, and they're silent, but there's some muttering and interaction beginning among them. One individual is walking up to the police chief and asking questions, and some people are shouting the occasional question from the audience, trying to get some direct responses rather than the kind of prefabricated 3x5 card business-as-usual approach that is being used, which, by the way, also is used at here in Santa Cruz to screen out questions. I saw it done frequently when those of us who were outside and seeing homeless people being arrested for sleeping tried to raise those questions in election forums. They would essentially discard those questions, or when many of them were asked, they would only ask one question, and other they would be given a kind of a discriminatory status. So it's a method of controlling, which actually is counterproductive in this situation. That this community is angry at what the Oakland Police Department has done, apparently, if I'm to judge by this video. And, of course, I come with my preconceptions. But the idea of trying to calm people down by letting them only filter them through 3x5 cards and then shutting them up is, and then arresting their spokespeople afterward, or the spokesman, I think they may have arrested somebody else too, which was the original point I was discussing here, is counterproductive in terms of they're trying to calm the community. But I'm glad that's not my job.
Those questions, if we're not being allowed to speak, there are people here that
it's hard for when the
community to ask questions or answers. They are not getting the answers that they deserve because you're being very disrespectful.
Nobody trusts you.
How is it possible that the officers could not distinguish between a gun or drugs? We are looking at every aspect of this case. I don't have the answer to that.
Came here unprepared, huh?
I'm just saying everything straight. Why you guys ain't got no answers?
This concludes our meeting. I want to thank you for your cooperation.
So people are upset that the meeting has been summarily ended. And people are kind of lingering in the room. Some are standing, some are sitting. Again, you can find this video on YouTube on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. Indiebay.org.
Can you tell me what we just saw going on?
East Bay.
For Alan Bluford, justice! For Alan Bluford, justice!
hand, the police chief is filing out the door as the people in the crowd, some of them are chanting. They're following him out the door of this room, which is always a medium-sized room. It's like a school building, a classroom size, a little bit larger than a classroom. And now the camera moves into the hallway as folks are walking down the hallway following the police chief, and presumably I think it was the mayor who was also there, Mayor Gina Kwan of Oakland. Some people are angry with him. And now they're going outside. It's daytime. And the taunts and angry shouts continue. But again, no violent action. And they're moving into the parking lot now. No, people are angry. They're being very careful not to be violent, it looks like. Because there are, of course, armed police, not many of them, but a few around. There's a guy with a bullhorn. I think this is the man who has been arrested, Chris Moreland, who is speaking loudly to the across the hood of the car. It's coming close to the mayor, to the police chief with his bullhorn. He keeps speaking loudly, justice, justice. And there are other people who are, you know, remonstrating with bald-headed police officers, African-American police officers. All the police chief himself is African-American, as are the officers with him. As is much of the crowd. There's some Caucasian folks there, too.
Huh? No, I'm protecting her. Because you are not here to protect us. You are not here to protect us.
So we're done. You're out of my
face.
He didn't do anything.
Yeah, don't grab him. Why are you grabbing him?
And the fellow with the hat, I think his name is Chris Moreland. He had a, I think he was the fellow with the bullhorn. Police chief is leaving in his car. There are some police officers who are remaining in a crowd of people. This is in a parking lot.
Whatever you want to do.
Let me tell you something, Sergeant. Let me tell you something. Let me tell you something. Let me tell you something, Sergeant Christopher. You are part of a corrupt police force that killed my people. Okay? And you cover up murders.
And this is an African American, Chris. The guy was arrested, I believe, talking to a white individual in a business suit as part of the police department or mayor's office.
You're upset.
He's calm, but he's pretty strong in terms of what he's saying.
Killers! Killers!
I'm not giving up the name. You guys are all killers. I don't give a fuck about your cases. You guys are murderers.
Actually, the fellow with the bullhorn is different than the individual was just talking about. Several individuals are confronting the police with, again, verbally. A large banner, justice for Alan Bluford, who is apparently the guy who's high school senior who was shot and murdered by the police in the view of the demonstrators. And there's there's a guy with a camera on a stick who is remonstrating with police officers about how they are killers and part of a essentially an organization that's killing African Americans in the neighborhood.
Just get away with murder.
That's it.
How you feel?
That's it.
You would think the police would just get up and leave. No particular reason to be there except to shut people up or shut people down, but they're still there. Interestingly enough, again, a lot of this is being caught on rather primitive video. And this one fellow in a white hat with the camera on a stick is following around an officer, continuing apparently to try to dialogue with him or photograph him or video him. And this is much more visual at this point than it is
all the other murders, lies.
Audio that you can hear the occasional taunts and angry shouts from the crowd. It looks like a couple of squad cars there. And there's genuine anger, I guess, that the police chief had absolutely no answer for the important questions. Who were the police officers involved? What about this phony story about a gun? And, of course, this was aggravated later by the arrest of someone in the crowd on what sounds like phony charges that disappeared the next day or two because he was outspoken.
You know, what did you feel about tonight? And I want to start with you, Cephas Johnson, Uncle Bobby. You've been through this process before. Police doing town halls, coming to churches, trying to do damage control. What you saw tonight, what do you think is going on here with the case of Alan Bluford?
I mean, tonight was totally a waste of time. To come here, and this meeting only lasts 30 minutes, if it lasted that. It was a PR campaign for Chief Jordan and the Oakland Police Department. As far as I'm concerned, it was more of a setup. They staged this whole thing just to appease their community, realizing that it's really not going to do nothing but anger more people because no answers were really given that was truthful. Everything that occurred in there was just a complete stage.
What did you feel about not being able to ask the questions directly where they made the community write the questions down on the card?
I felt like I was totally kept quiet by the way it was set up. I mean, denied the right to speak to the issues that was really at hand. And then to hear them lie about, now it's the media talking about the son was in a shootout instead of a police officer going to the family and telling them, you know, my question still remains, why not fire the officer that went to the family and told them that their son was in a shootout?
So there was an officer that said this?
Yeah.
Explain how this works.
Well, Adam and his wife wanted to know what happened. They then had an officer come to, didn't come to their home, either came to their home or called them in, one or the other. He went there at the police station and told them that their son was involved in a shootout with an officer. You know, this is what they told the family. And so our question is, who is the officer that told the family that, and why is he not fired? It's in their procedures and policy, to be honest, not to tell no lies.
Because it wasn't a shootout.
It wasn't no shootout.
Wow, so the Oakland police have changed their story like 3 or 4 times now.
Yes, since the beginning. I mean, the gun was 30 feet, now it's 5 feet. You know, I just the lies are really stabbing the family bad.
What do you think is going on to the family where their son is being dragged through the mud? People are looking at backgrounds and all this because they did this with your nephew. What is the process? How does the family deal with that? They're burying Alan Bluford today, and then you still have this character assassination, both by the police and the press.
I mean, that's the most painful thing. It's one thing to lose a loved one to the police, but then when the police come and begin to demonize and character assassinate your loved one that had just been murdered, I mean, it's like a double slap. It's a stab. It's painful, and it does nothing but make the family angry in their mourning, in their grieving.
We appreciate that. What would you say to the family right now? Any course of action they should take?
To the family, they have to really begin to just stay in prayer, because this justice system is designed not for them to get any real justice. And in this true process that we see in Oakland, and the way it was staged today, is a complete setup to not allow them to get the real justice that they're entitled to. So, you know, stay on your knees, allow the community to support you and love you.
We see this all around, because we see all the confusion simultaneously with the Trayvon Martin case.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, all this different stuff, witnesses changing their mind. It seems like it's a setup to say that the trial wasn't fair, therefore everything has to be dismissed.
Exactly. And that's what we're seeing here, you know. To me, this whole thing was staged today, you know, and of course, no real answers came out of it. You know, again, it's good the family wasn't here, because it would have been real painful for them to sit and see something like this.
Uncle Bobby, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Peace.
And again, that was a video on YouTube. Angry residents confront Oakland police chief and run him out over lies about Alan Bluford killing. Stop that from replaying. Again, if you want to view it yourself, although we pretty much went through it, it's on indiebay.org/East Bay, and the story that it's under is a longer story about Free Chris, interviews with Occupy Legal's Kate Hallinan and Occupy Oakland's Layla, about a guy who spoke out at that meeting and afterward, and was then arrested for bullhorning his commentary to the police on vast number of charges, and then these were reduced to a small charge, and now he's out. But it's an example of what they're doing to intimidate people. But of course, if people are angry and united and upset enough, that will add fuel to the fire rather than frighten people home. In Santa Cruz, on the other hand, where it's more of a sort of an avocation, and I'm speaking for myself too, I could comfortably go watch movies for the rest of my life. Probably nobody would bother me, but it doesn't do any good. All around issues are important to me for me to do that, although it can be quite refreshing and quite relaxing, I must say. The reason I got involved in this particular Oakland story and decided to cover it at some length for the last hour here on Free Radio, and that's what you're tuned to, in case for some reason the transmitter has magically begun to work again, 101.3 FM, but I assume we are streaming. You go to TuneUp and put in FRSC, and you'll get this our stream. I don't have a longer address. It's something I haven't committed to memory. I originally noticed a story in yesterday's Chronicle, actually Friday's Chronicle, by a right-wing columnist, Chip Johnson. Oakland police chief fails to calm suspicions. And I got suspicious myself reading this story. I'm going to read some of it, perhaps all of it, and give you an example of how the mainstream, you heard the alternate media presenting this, and actually saw the video and heard the questions answered by police chief, or not answered by police chief Jordan. But here's how a Chronicle reporter was passing that on to the community. Armed with good intentions but not enough right answers, Oakland Police Chief Howard Jordan stood before an assembly at Acts Full Gospel Church the other night to talk about the recent killing of a black teenager by police. What was supposed to be an event to soothe community and police relations quickly turned into a public relations disaster. And that really is the focus to some extent of the article. It's like this guy is a sort of a paid PR guy for the cops who's critiquing how it could have been done better or something, you know, how to calm down these wild and crazy Oakland residents who are somehow overly concerned when the cops engage in their usual picking off of this person or that. The Wednesday night presentation from police officials, which included an oh-so-unnecessary police primer on the investigative process, lasted only 35 minutes. We only heard about half of that. Before Jordan pulled the plug amid catcalls, some of them obscene, from the audience. The police speak only made an already suspicious crowd even more suspicious. Again, there's nothing about the facts here yet about the story. We're just the police and the crowd. Jordan was there to discuss details of the officer-involved shooting of Alan Bluford on May 6th. Authorities have said, here come the, at least the police story, that Bluford, an 18-year-old senior at Skyline High School who was about to graduate, was shot and killed as he ran from police across 92nd Avenue near Birch Street in East Oakland on an early Sunday morning. Jordan said Bluford was carrying a handgun. He said police had three witnesses who said Bluford pointed the gun at police. But there were a lot of listeners, including congregation members, who just weren't buying the police version of events. At one point, a small contingent of Occupy protesters and others who were in the church stood in unison and turned their backs and raised their fists in the air as Jordan tried to answer questions about the attendees. And actually, it didn't stop him from answering questions at all, and it was silent. At least at the beginning. The chief was drowned out by questions that were really accusations in disguise. Why do officers shoot to kill when the suspects are black? Someone shouted. And actually, those shouts followed earlier attempts to get specific information about why the police officer's name wasn't being released. What about the details of the shooting? Part of the meeting was to share factual information, Jordan said Thursday. Some people have issues with accepting factual information. I wasn't there to judge whether the case of the shooting was justified or not. I was there to provide the facts as we see it. As Oakland's police brass left the church, a small group of protesters confronted them outside before turning on a group of uniformed officers. Turning on. What that means is arguing with, demanding answers from. And it makes it sound like there's something violent happening, when in fact what's happening is an attempt to uncover the rationale of the real violence going on in Oakland, the murderous violence by people who are in a privileged, legal, and weapon-heavy position to commit more such violence. Officers arrested two people, both adults, after the confrontation, police said. I don't know who the other person was. As difficult as the relationship between Oakland police and advocates for justice may be, it doesn't explain the lack of outrage for the most serious problem that exists in the community, the homicides of African-American men at the hands of other African-American men. In 2010, the statistics provided by the city show that African-Americans made up 28% of the population and 78% of its homicide victims. That's not the result of overzealous police actions. But it's not the issue here. And it's interesting, Chip Jordan, the writer, is kind of taking us off on that red herring. It would be great if we had that much passion for all the people being shot, but we don't hear Occupy protesters or anyone else protesting about that. Well, perhaps because the people who are getting shot by people who aren't in the police force are not really readily accessible and protected by the state and empowered and paid by the state in the same way that police officers are. I mean, could that be the reason? Pastor of the church, Bishop Bob Jordan, on 66th Avenue in East Oakland. Unfortunately, what the police department regards as an investigation of an individual shooting, many people in Oakland's African-American community view as an ongoing pattern of indiscriminate police violence aimed straight at them and, worse, their teenage and young adult children. And given department statistics, there is certainly a case to be made. Since May 2010, there have been 9 fatal officer-involved shootings, I'll give the writer credit for this, in Oakland. That is to say, for exposing this fact. And 8 of those killed have been African-American males, according to department records. So apparently that's an even bigger record than the statistics of African-Americans who aren't cops shooting African-Americans. The homicide victims are 78% of African-Americans in the general population, and it looks like 8 out of 9... It's about the same statistic in the police department. So the police aren't any better than killers at large in shooting African Americans. That's more. Police did not provide statistics for the non-fatal officer shooting, so it's just people who are killed that are being covered here. That's more reality than most communities, regardless of race, religion, gender, or ethnicity, would need to raise legitimate questions about police actions in their neighborhoods. Among some of the most faithful, hearty souls in Jackson's flock of 7,000 members, there are many who place their trust in God, but few place their trust in the police. We got a scripted response from the chiefs at a thoroughly disgusted James Harris, a 48-year-old member, church member. I came here to get questions answered. You're supposed to get the truth at church. And I guess there's more to this story that I'm interested in hearing about. I mean, there's some stuff in the story that I want to have to commend the writer for bringing up. And he did give a short quote, much shorter than to the police chief, of critics. But you don't hear anything about police officers arresting people for essentially speaking up. And there's a sort of an, maybe I'm paranoid, but an implication that Occupy Oakland, that Chip Johnson, this writer, does not like, I see from his other columns, you know, should really just shut up, and what is it doing interfering? And in other words, it's sort of, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, these people are heroes who raise these issues, just as the people in Santa Cruz are heroes. It takes a lot of courage to do that. Indeed, one gets more courage in numbers, and as the numbers dwindle, I think people tend to get more scared, and it's harder to act on your best impulses. So that's certainly a concern. I think that may be all I have to say about this particular issue. Again, we've been talking about Chris Moreland's arrest by the Oakland PD for essentially raising his voice at a cover-up whitewash session, as I regard it, by the Oakland Police Department around the killing or murder of Alan Bluford, a African-American high school senior, for running from the police department. Is that running while black, perhaps? And the other question as to who actually got arrested. But there's some confusion where there was another person arrested. Looking at a second story on that issue, again from the Indy Bay website. Let's see what we got here. Police said Buford pointed a gun at an officer who then shot the teen three times in the chest. The officer also wounded himself in the foot. Department spokesman Officer Joanna Watson said the department initiated a policy to hold community meetings following fatal police shootings to share what information we can without jeopardizing the investigation. Transparency is important not only for the victims' families, for the community at large, said Oakland civil rights attorney John Burris, who is representing the Bluford family. The issue always is the information being communicated one-sided or is it balanced? It could have a positive effect, but it could have a negative effect if only negative information about the victim is being communicated. Police held the meeting among other reasons to set straight street talk and other rumors that Bluford was shot in the back. Burris said that is untrue and acknowledged that wrong information or rumors can make a bad situation worse. Information should be given out sooner rather than later, Burris said. The rumors themselves can be much more detrimental than anything else. On Wednesday night, Police Chief Howard Jordan recounted the events leading up to the shooting and said again that Bluford was armed and he was not shot in the back. Police have witnesses and physical evidence supporting that information, according to this story by the Oakland Tribune. Kristen J. Bender and Harry Harris. I'm sorry, I'm always skeptical of the Oakland Tribune, or often skeptical. Police said that shortly after midnight on May 6, police approached three people in the 1900 block of 90th Avenue. When one man took off running, officers chased him to the 8200 block of Birch Street, where Bluford pointed his gun and fired on them. About 100 people, friends and family of the victim and others, turned out at Acts Full Gospel Church for the meeting, including more than two dozen Occupy members. Police said the Occupy protesters were heckling and disruptive at the meeting. As people left the church, protesters tried to block Jordan from heading out, followed him outside, and surrounded his car, preventing him from leaving. I didn't see that in the video. They were trying to talk to him as he got into his car. They were denouncing him. They were continuing to stay around there. But there was no, for example, concerted police effort to clear a line, nor did their attempt to seem to need to be one, according to the video that I saw, which I imagine is the video that reflects what happened. Additional officers were called for crowd control when officers was pushed and spat on by an Occupy protester, police said. Not highlighted or mentioned in the video. The protesters left. The person who police said pushed the officer and a man had an arrest warrant for a parole violation was later arrested at the Coliseum BART station. Mike King, a member of the Occupy Oakland movement, said Occupy protesters were upset because they believed Jordan was not addressing an overall systematic problem with police brutality. But as for that so-called parole violation, it was apparently enough to hold him on $100,000 bail, according to the cops, but not enough to even get a charge or a parole hold 2 days later in court. So And there was certainly no violence that could be seen in the activity, but if the parole violation was for the guy with the bullhorn, he was definitely making his voice heard at this event. So, let's take a little musical break, lest I belabor this too far. And again, your phone calls are welcome, 427-3772.
People, I'll tell you a story, an 8-year-long story of power and pride. British Lord Vesey and Vincent Lingyari were opposite men on opposite sides. Vesey was fat with money and muscle. Beef was his business, broad was his door. Vincent was lean, he spoke very little. He had no bank balance, hard dirt was his floor. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. The Rangers were working for nothing but rations. But once they had gathered the wealth of the land, daily the pressure got tighter and tighter. The Ranger decided they must make a stand. They picked up their swags and started off walking. At Water Creek, they sat themselves down. Now it don't sound like much, but it sure got tongues talking. Back at the homestead, and then in the town. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. The best man said, I'll double your wages, 18 quid a week you'll have in your hands. Vincent said, we're not talking about wages. We're sitting right here till we get our land. Vesey man roared, Vesey man thundered. You don't stand a chance of a cinder and snow. Vince said, if we fall, others are rising. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. Then Vincent Lingyari boarded an airplane and landed in Sydney, big city of lights. And daily he went round softly speaking his story to all kinds of men from all walks of life. And Vincent sat down with big politicians. This affair, they told him, it's a matter of state. Let us sort it out while your people are hungry. Vincent said, no thanks, we know how to wait. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. Then Vincent Lingyari returned in an airplane back to his country once more to sit down. And he told his people, let the stars keep on turning. We have friends in the south, in the cities and towns. Eight years went by, eight long years of waiting, till one day a tall stranger appeared in the land. And he came with lawyers, and he came with great ceremony, and through Vincent's fingers poured a handful of sand. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. that was the story of Vincent Lignari. But this is the story of something much more. How power and privilege can unmove a people who know where they stand. Stand in the law. From little things, big things grow. 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 From little things, big things grow.
Yeah, that was Paul Kelly. Not quite sure who Paul Kelly is, but some of you folks may know. You're tuned to Free Radio. The stream at TuneIn, if you Bing for that or Google for that, you can go there and then put in FRSC and you'll find us, Free Radio Santa Cruz. From Little Things, Big Things Grow had me in mind of the crackdown on Occupy the Farm that happened up in Albany a week or two ago. I'm going to read a little story about that, dated May 19th, by Susie Cadgill from Truthout website. The national movement looked local with an Earth Day action that took over a long-disputed tract of land in California's East Bay and turned it into a community farm with 2 acres of planted crops. Monday morning, activists were removed by force, but they vowed to return. That was today is the 27th, so I think that was probably 2 Mondays ago. Gopal Dianimi climbed onto a truck, megaphone in hand, a straw hat shading his face, as he spoke to the crowd gathered at the locked gates. Farmers, young and old, took the tract on April 22nd, led by the Brass Liberation Orchestra. If you've ever planted a seed, if you've ever pulled a weed, you are a farmer, Dianini said. I'm ready to walk through that gate and take back the tract. He continued, because if it is the right thing to do, then we have every right to do it. The crowd cheered as the chains on the gates were cut open and hundreds flooded onto the Gill tract, several acres of UC property up in the Berkeley area that had been contested for more than a decade. They brought tools, straw, chicken and portable coops, and 15,000 starter plants that had been growing in greenhouses around Northern California for the past several months before finding their homes in this Class 1 soil in the sleepy bedroom community of Albany, just north of Berkeley. 3 weeks later, police in riot gear raided the property, arresting 9 activists, including Dianini. A few months ago, when one activist approached me and whispered, "Save the date, we're going to plant a garden," this is not exactly the ending I had expected. Farmers set to work on April 22nd, unloading fresh compost for rows. The university contends that the farm has impeded high-stakes agricultural research projects set to begin in mid-May. The farmers contend that the university is placing profits ahead of the community's interest in this last parcel of high-quality arable land in the developed East Bay. They point to the UC's plan to develop the tract with a 35,000-plus square-foot Whole Foods store and for-profit senior housing center. According to the UC's proposed master plan, the space where the activist crops now stand and UC scientists now research will be sodded for youth baseball diamonds and other recreational space. For now, it's just 70 well-trodden rows of hand-planted organic seedlings surrounded by police in riot gear. The Gill tract is unlike what most of the public has come to expect from Occupy. Actions meant as protest, sending a message as part of a broader demonstration against economic, political, and societal ills. As it stands, the farm has sent a message about the privatizing of public universities and public land, genetically modified foodstuffs, and urban farming and food sovereignty. But this message is secondary to the action. The farm is not only and not really a message, because it is a farm. Occupy has inserted itself into a long and protracted battle between a community and a privatizing public institution. If the University of California is forced to back to the bargaining table with the community, Occupy actually stands to win. Two portable co-ops and four egg-laying chickens arrived at the farm on April 22nd. Sorry, two portable coops, not co-ops. But that win comes at a cost. The rules of the public relations war dictate that first the farm must be bulldozed, the children's garden razed, the farmers handcuffed and dragged out toward the cameras clustered at the locked gates. Then perhaps its message will be heard. While some wiped away tears as the university workers drove backhoes and dump trucks into the farm, one activist said she was happy the police had come. "It takes it to the next level," she said, beaming. For the last several years, the UC has raised tuition while suffering budget shortfalls and enacting on-campus austerity measures. In its 2012-2013 budget, the UC stated it is exploiting sources of additional revenues. For the Gill Tract, these revenues have come in many forms, from partnerships with multinational big ag companies to long-term leases for big box retail. Farmers pull up overgrown mustard grass and rototill the rows on April 22nd. And that's actually a picture below, I believe. The University of California was founded with financial aid from legislation which established land-grant universities and objective practical education in agriculture and landscape gardening. It was in that spirit that the UC obtained the then 104-acre Gill Tract in 1928. Over the years, they established an agricultural research station while parceling out and developing the tract until only 15 acres were left. That development faced little pushback until the late 90s, when community groups, nonprofits, and UC Berkeley professors began a campaign to turn part of the tract into the world's first university center on sustainable urban agriculture and food systems. They toiled for years as the UC contracted with corporations such as Novartis and British Petroleum to share in discoveries made through tract research on genetic modification. "We feel this behavior represents a distinct bias within UC to favor global industrial agriculture at the expense of the people of California," they wrote in 2000. In 2002, another group attempted to begin the farm conversation again, this time with backing from the local Teachers Association, school district, Mayor Berkeley, and farm-to-table food star Alice Waters, all to no avail. We've been attempting to designate the Gill Tract as an agricultural easement for the past 15 years, and the UC has stonewalled us, Albany resident and Albany Farm Alliance member Jarena Larson told me as police blockaded the tract. Larson lives across the street from the farm. "I used to be 99.9% into this," she said, looking at the lines of police. "Now I'm in at 150%. In a prime part of the East Bay where modest homes cost upward of $500,000, the Gill Tract is an important holding for the UC. But as a part of the university's capital projects venture, it's unclear whether the tract is as important holding for the people of California as well, at least those outside tiny Albany. Albany is but 1.7 square miles and 18,000 residents strong. Tax revenue from a Whole Foods could go far for this little town, at least further than the $0 the UC currently pays. The farm lies less than a quarter mile from neighboring Berkeley, the residents of which would have no say and no stake in the development of the tract. Perhaps this is how Albany always would have wanted it. Their town was founded in 1908, following a protracted battle adjacent to the Gill Tract over Berkeley residents hauling and dumping their garbage there. There was a shotgun standoff at a nearby corner. On Monday morning, the shotguns were back at that corner, this time held by UC police officers. Police locked the gates on May 11th while farmers continued to work the fields inside the tract. Shortly after the UC police locked entrance and exit gates at the farm last Friday, UC Berkeley student and farm activist Marika Iyer perched on the perimeter fence and addressed the crowd. "This isn't about Albany," she said, gesturing toward the town. "This is about food sovereignty and sustainability for the whole bioregion. Urban and urban-adjacent agriculture produces about 30% of the U.S. food supply. Food deserts in the low-income communities prosper." Not sure. It must be deserts and not desserts. "Food deserts in low-income communities prosper about as well as fruits and vegetables in the East Bay's Mediterranean climate, and poor city residents can spend as much as half their income on food each year. Controlling even some of that income would mean the kind of food sovereignty farm activists speak of so glowingly." This is just an idea that seems to really be resonating in all different types of communities, said Claiborne MacDonald, a farm activist who has traveled across the country for the Occupy movement. We're out of agricultural land. We have run out. This is the end of it. And food sovereignty is a pretty old and new idea that I think people feel in their bones. We need food around us. We can't import everything. But food sovereignty is not an issue Occupy the Farm could solve on its own. At best, the 2 acres activists planted with a variety of vegetables can produce a little more than 100 pounds of produce each week. Where the project's real value lies, activists say, is in its educational power and example for nearby communities. Albany city workers dispose of farm supplies on May 14th. There's another picture. Our vision for the future is to turn this into the sort of hub for urban agriculture, said UC Berkeley student Leslie Haddock, who helped to plan this action for the past several months. We've seen people trying the democratic process for 15 years. These people are really frustrated. We're sort of taking it to the next level. This is how we're communicating with this university. We're saying it's not okay to just keep ignoring people. You have to address this. Now, I'm going to pause briefly in this article to point out something. Here's a person who has quoted UC Berkeley student Leslie Haddock as helping to plan this action for the past several months. This is an action that broke a lock, entered private property in the sense that it was, well, it's public property managed by UC, supposedly, just as the courthouse claims that it can ban people from the indoors regardless of the First Amendment and ban people from the grounds after 7 o'clock. But here is someone who is admitting that she engaged in a conspiracy to trespass and probably a conspiracy to occupy. This is something that she talks about. But could she be talking about it if she were being charged with felonies, as many people in Santa Cruz, or a number of us, 11 of us in Santa Cruz, have found to be the case, and many, many more people who were involved in an action which they thought was for the public benefit, and which I think was probably for the public benefit, to raise the issue of a criminal bankster organization keeping unused a piece of property year after year in a downtown, in a community where the downtown space is not only valuable but is needed for, could be profitably used for a community center. To discuss this issue has in essence become a felonious behavior, or is something that attorneys will tell you is something you should not do, particularly if you're a defendant. What if you're just a potential defendant? It's something you can only really see by contrasting what goes on here with other cities and understanding that the kind of open dialogue that you see in this article is not possible here in Santa Cruz because of the kind of prosecutions that are happening. It seems to me, I mean, I have trouble talking to other defendants about these issues who are afraid that informants are listening, who are afraid that their defenses will be compromised of any kind of admissions. The most innocent and productive and positive forms of behavior, trying to turn a vacant, unused profit asset by a criminal organization, Wells Fargo, which is displaced thousands, if not more, from their homes, which is the leading foreclosure meister in the entire country, which is riddled with proven fraudulent accounting practices up in the Bay Area, in which I can't seem to get any clear evidence of that here in Santa Cruz, because in spite of all our Occupy foreclosure organizing, we can't seem to muster anything more than a, gosh, you guys, you supervisors, get it all together and give us a report 6 months later when we're not getting a real report. But anyway, this kind of positive action can't even be discussed. And that, I think, is either the conscious or the unconscious motive of authorities who are pressing, because they're afraid the discussion of these issues leads to action. And action on these issues is something that goes against the existing 1% rules, 99% follow order of things throughout the world. If Greece has to starve, if Spain has to be unemployed, if Afghani mothers have to die and their children die, that's just how it goes. If 500,000 children in Iraq have to be starved to death in the 90s, according to Madeleine Albright, that's a price that's worth paying. These kinds of things, which come to the fore in ways that suddenly cannot be avoided, can become the impetus for unstoppable action. And that, I think, is something the authorities can't tolerate. As long as it's in the nature of a Sunday morning radio show that just chats and chats and says the same thing every week, it's fine. But when people show up in massive numbers at the city manager's office or in a vacant bank building or even at a courtroom, then the authorities start getting anxious. And they start throwing around words, law and order, vandalism, resisting arrest, battery on an officer. Those suddenly become useful tools, as a police officer would say, for reining in social discontent. Or the cry for economic and political justice. Continuing with this Albany's Occupy the Farm article. Activists broke the locks on the Gill Tract and occupied the land on April 22nd, Earth Day, in solidarity with the global La Via Campesina peasant farmers movement. Many of the farmers are local Bay Area Occupy veterans. Many are not. Some live blocks away and others come from outside the state. All those who pitched a tent on the farm put in some hours of work for its benefit. Over and over again, throughout the three-week occupation, farm activists emphasized to me they were there to farm, not to live, and not to protest. Along the 70 planted rows, the basic seed library, the children's ladybug punch, and chicken coops, it's clear that there are stakes in this ground. Police were dispatched early Monday to clear an encampment that didn't exist, according to Occupy the Farm activist Ashoka Finley. The group had removed tents from the tract last Friday in a good-faith gesture toward the researchers who were set to begin planting. A banner which led to the April 22nd march to the tract remains after the May 14th raid. That wasn't enough for the UC Berkeley researcher Damon Lish, who likened the farm occupation to sharing an office with a hostile colleague. Lish, who conducts research on genetically modified corn, in which Novartis has purchased a stake, has been a vocal opponent of the farm, but not of its goals. I think it would be a terrible precedent if they were allowed to stay. It's just profoundly undemocratic, he told reporters last week. What I hope will happen is it will be resolved peacefully and people who advocate for urban farming will be allowed a seat at the table. UC Berkeley researcher Miguel Altieri came prepared to plant his dry farm tomatoes last Wednesday morning. We're going to show that the coexistence of research and the occupation is possible, he said. I wanted to contribute to an atmosphere that would promote dialogue toward a peaceful resolution, which is basically the commitment of the university to preserve this land for a center for urban agriculture. We need a center for urban agriculture badly. When Altieri came to check on his tomatoes on Friday, UC police would not allow him onto the tract. The tract is closed to all following the May 14th raid. The local community has had mixed reviews for the farm. We don't need the farm for education, and we definitely don't need it for food, wrote a commentator on local news site Albany Patch. Others support an urban farm on the Gill Tract, just not this one. I strongly disagree with the tactics that were used, but I think the issues that have been raised are good ones, said Albany resident and Berkeley graduate student Christopher Church. I really think there's a gem here that's going to be crushed if it keeps going the way it's going. Church advocates for a return to the negotiating table with the university and local community say, what I see is the probable conclusion will just end up not benefiting anyone. UC police came armed with pneumatic pepper ball guns on May 14th. Others are happy that something finally happened on the Gill Tract after all these years. After the UC shut off water to the farm in the early days of the occupation, local residents mobilized to fill large tanks in order to continue cultivating the crops. After the UC locked the gates to the farm, they helped to lift those huge tanks up and over the chain-link fences. When the UC Berkeley Dean of the College of Natural Resources, Keith Gillis, visited the tract last Tuesday, he was visibly angry, pacing and red-faced as he chastised the farmers. Gillis delivered a letter from the university asserting its interest in finding a way to allow for a peaceful coexistence of urban farming and agricultural research on the Gill Tract. The university once again demanded the occupiers leave. Peace, peace indeed. But they did not. The next day, the UC filed a lawsuit against 14 named and 150 does who they allege conspired to take over the tract. Well, maybe I spoke too soon. Maybe they are being accused. I guess a lawsuit is not the same as a criminal prosecution. One is they're suing you, the other is they're jailing you. The UC dropped one of the defendants after learning that she is currently studying in Peru. The suit seeks financial damages for the activist's alleged vandalism, how familiar, as well as the rental value for the land for the duration of the occupation. The UC reserved two seats for the farmers at a private meeting about the future of the tract. On the condition that the farmers first quit the land, they also said they would drop civil litigation and criminal prosecution if the farmers did not attempt to reoccupy. Activists declined, they said, partially out of concern that anything they might say could be used against them in that very prosecution and litigation. It was a slow and methodical crackdown. UC police visited every day for 3 days before the raid, making a dispersal order and threatening activists with arrest each visit. On Wednesday morning, they blocked vehicle traffic into and out of the tract. On Friday morning, that's 2 weeks ago, the tract was locked to everyone. Activists hopped the fence in plain view. None of us are interested in having this turn into a police confrontation. We're really all interested in seeing an urban farm here, occupier Haddock told me then. Only by Monday morning did it become the kind of riot squad raid to which Occupy activists across the country have grown accustomed. UC police came loaded down with tear gas, grenade launchers, pepper ball guns, less lethal projectile shotguns, and other crowd control measures. A squad of police block, and a picture of a squad of police blocking another entrance to the tract on May 14th. You're dealing with people whose emotions are running high, and there's lots of farm equipment around, said UCPD Lieutenant Eric Tejada. Every piece is a potential weapon. We had to be prepared in case someone picked up a hoe and attacked a police officer. Residents of nearby UC housing expressed their support for the farm on May 1st. No one did pick up a hoe, and the dozens of officers dispatched from 8 of the university's 10 campuses arrested only 9 people. 2 for trespassing and several for remaining for an unlawful assembly across the street. Watch out, a UC-hired private security guard told demonstrators. They're arresting people here for no reason. On May 15th, farmers marched to the tract with sunflowers chanting, "Whose farm? The people's farm." Activists were enthused when they reconverged and marched to the tract on Tuesday. They spoke of other occupiers inspired by this farm now planning land grabs across California in Vallejo, Vacaville, Davis, and beyond, but they hadn't forgotten their own 70 rows. Wednesday afternoon, the defenders in the lawsuits would all be served with temporary restraining orders from the university, making it a further crime for them to set foot back on that land and water those plants. The ruling drew on gang injunction law in California, essentially labeling the Occupy the Farm as a criminal farming occupation. But they didn't know that yet. Dianini addressed the crowd again. This is a long-term fight. They think their fences can stop us. They think their arrests can stop us. They can't. We took that space and we can take it back whenever we want. Susie Cagle is the author of that story. She's a graphic journalist. She has written and drawn for The Atlantic, Good, American Prospect, Alternet, The All in These Times, Campus Progress, Cartoon Movement, and many others on Occupy, Crisis Pregnancy Centers, Loan Bubbles, and more. And again, the name of this article, and you can find it online, is Occupy the Farm Dug In and Dug Up. And I think it is on East Bay Indie Media. I'm going to double check now and see if I can find that. And encourage people to check it out if they want to review some of the arguments. That's been one of the, there have been only a couple of Occupy, there have essentially been three prongs that I can think of offhand of the Occupy Santa Cruz movement that have continued in ways visible to me, although I agreed have not been really in touch with everything. One is the defense of the Santa Cruz 11 in the courts. A second is the Occupy the Food movement, which has been continuing to percolate, and Gene shows up with food every so often at the Occupy assemblies, of which there is one today at 2 o'clock at the main post office, as I understand it, although I'm not sure if I will be there or not. I'm still recuperating from health problems and anticipating some surgery, maybe, somewhere down the road. And the third prong is Occupy Foreclosure, which continues to go and make little speeches to the Board of Supes. I shouldn't be demeaning, because I also go and make little speeches about the same subject. But I'm concerned that the people who are doing this are very concerned that they have these illusions that their political connections with Supervisor Leopold and other notables are going to somehow turn the trick, when in fact what they need to be doing is organizing in the community. And it was too bad that the one foreclosed house that Occupy people were in had a falling out with the owner, and that they weren't able to present a united front when the sheriffs came a week ago Wednesday. That's a pity. But that doesn't stop the reality and the need to stop these foreclosures. And I encourage people to stay in touch with Occupy if you want to do find people of like mind and also like courage. I mean, that's really one of the great advantages, the great differences from a year ago in Santa Cruz in terms of activists. I mean, we've always had courageous activists, but they're often operating off kind of in isolation or in their own groups. Occupy was an opportunity for people to come together to form some solidarity with each other, and that has remained to a large extent. Though there have been falling outs, there have been differences, there have been fights. You know, one group says the other is a bunch of privileged white women. The others, you know, says a bunch of firebrands who have no respect for consensus and are, you know, likely to be violent or something. You get these concerns that come up, but people come together to support each other, I notice, more than they fall apart. There's always going to be differences, and I'm going to be reading some of those concerns and differences of opinion I have on discussing diversity of tactics, the phrase that says it's okay to carry a shield if you're going into a protest demonstration because you might get hit by the police, or a black bloc tactic that involves diverting police who are beating up protesters by, I don't know, attacking property off to the side is not necessarily in all cases a bad thing. Or that masks, while, you know, aren't everybody's preference, and I don't wear them, may be a good protective device and actually may have protected a lot of people from bogus prosecution for the 75 River Street events. And also protect people from the kind of harassment that is clearly happening across the country in Santa Cruz and Oakland. And I'm going to be reading probably some more stuff about other mass trials that are happening of people who are engaging in nothing other than peaceful protest. At most, I suppose, trespass, if the state wants to really push that kind of issue, and really there's a very positive aspect to the kinds of so-called trespasses that are being the charges leveled against people in different cities. The real trespassers are those who've monopolized the public space, aren't excluding the 99% from it, are so regulating them to the benefit of the 1%, which is the system that a lot of us are fighting to or want to see end. I think it's hard to say that most of us are engaged in active fighting. People are engaged in active survival behaviors a lot of the time. So there was something else I wanted to read before I turn to the next musical break, and that's a story from Dennis Bulwa of San Francisco Chronicle. Not my favorite paper, but one that I do read somewhat religiously, unfortunately, mainly because of Section B, for those of you who are the occasional Chronicle reader. That's the local section up in San Francisco that has the legal stuff, the stuff about the Occupy movement, usually from a very hostile point of view, but also some stuff about court decisions around rights and so forth. Here's a story, Occupy Police Monitor Questions Response to Occupy. This is from about a month ago, May 1st. The federal court monitored tracking reforms, and the Oakland Police Force said Monday that the effort had met outright stagnation and raised questions about officers using of beanbag shotguns and other weapons during what he called a military-type response to Occupy demonstrations. The court ordered reforms, many of them focused on how the department polices its own officers, haven't progressed in 6 months and have gone backward in the past year, said a report by the monitor, Robert Warshaw. Critics of the department said the findings brought Oakland's police force closer to a federal takeover. And I think that possibly that's even happened, but I'm not quite, I don't think it actually has. Stagnation is troubling. After 9 years, more progress should be made, said John Burris, one of the two attorneys who brought a civil suit a decade ago that led to court oversight. We must seriously explore the next step. Monitor dismayed. Warshaw said that although police had performed well at times while dealing with Occupy protesters camped outside City Hall, he was thoroughly dismayed by some officers' actions. Any advances made by the department, Warshaw said, may have been put in doubt in the face of these events. In a statement, the city officials focused on the positive aspects of the report, apparently so does the story, which expressed optimism that Police Chief Howard Jordan, an agency veteran who took over 6 months ago, would drive home the reform effort. OPD has turned the corner, Jordan said, and our new, more collaborative relationship with the monitor and plaintiff's attorneys will soon bear results and compliance findings. And I will be pulling out, and the check will be in the mail. Forgive me. Mayor Gene Kwan said the department is demonstrating more consistent constitutional policing and an improved level of accountability to the community. Not from what we've seen from happen 3 days ago outside Jordan's meeting trying to defend the shooting of Alan Bluford. And then the subsequent arrest of Chris, the Occupy Oakland activist, on bogus charges. The report revealed new details about several police clashes with protesters that remain under investigation. Warshaw said that Iraq War veteran Scott Olson, who suffered a brain injury during an Occupy protest October 25th, had been shot with a beanbag by an Oakland SWAT officer. Several other police agencies were assisting Oakland that night, and it had been unclear who fired the object. Warshaw said green residue on Olson's hat matched the dye left by Oakland SWAT team beanbags, and noted that as Olson lay wounded on the ground, another officer lobbed a tear gas canister into a crowd of people helping him. Neither officer was named in the report. This is 6 months later. Videos of some police actions during Occupy protests are concerned as to the manner in which non-deadly munitions were utilized, wrote Warshaw, a former police chief of Rochester, New York, and deputy drug czar under President Bill Clinton. Referring to the use of beanbags as well as tear gas and flashbang grenades intended to disperse a crowd, Warshaw said, "These recordings lead us to ask additional questions about the level of force that was used by OPD officers and whether that use of force was in compliance with the department's use of force policies." Of course, I have posted online, but not examined, the Santa Cruz Police Department and Sheriff's Police Office's use of force policies. I believe that's part of their general policy manual. I encourage people to check them out, report on them, and get back to us, because while I have the time to get these reports, I often don't take the time to go through them in the way that I should. Outright stagnation. Overall, the report, which covers the period from October through December, concluded that Oakland had the same number of reforms to complete as it did in the previous two quarters, a situation Warshaw called an outright stagnation in the overall compliance picture. The report noted with optimism that the most recent quarter was the first under Jordan, who the monitor said took over at a tumultuous time. During the chief's tenure, progress has been made with regard to looking at innovative ways to bring about change, Warshaw wrote. Progress has been made and with regard to looking at innovative. So they're looking at innovative ways. Okay. U.S. District Judge Thelton Henderson ordered the department to make changes after an infamous case more than a decade ago in which four officers who called themselves the Riders were accused of imposing vigilante justice in West Oakland. One remains a fugitive, while the other three were never convicted at trial. Similar to Santa Cruz, where Code Blue, homeless people being beaten up by the police under the eye of then-police chief Gino Pini, were fired from the police department, a rarity, and then actually prosecuted, an even greater rarity, but acquitted here in Santa Cruz. One of these days I'm going to go back and get copies of all the papers for that and actually review those cases, which come up in conversation a lot. In the past year, Henderson has grown increasingly frustrated with Oakland, saying he was prepared to impose more federal control. That's all we need is Homeland Security, perhaps, knocking around. I don't know. Could be a different department with a conflicting jurisdiction that's supposed to swat down embarrassing, overly brutal local police departments. A hearing on potential receivership is scheduled for December. Gosh, only 6 months away. Investigation farmed out. Warshaw ripped the slowness of the investigations into Occupy-related complaints against police. The department's plan to farm out the cases to a private firm rather than use its internal affairs division to determine whether officers should face discipline is an alarming development, Warshaw wrote. He said the decision was made because the department couldn't handle the size and scope of the complaints. Police officials have said they farmed out the cases in part because internal affairs officers had conflicts of interest, having been assigned to help out during the protests. Captain Paul Figueroa, head of internal affairs, was the police operations chief during the October 25th protest. Why did they do that? They knew he was going to have to sit in judgment on these people, said Jim Channon, one of the lawyers in the writers' lawsuit. If you run a military organization and you can't find people who are willing to enforce the rules of the department, that's the strongest argument for receivership I've heard to date. No chest camera. The report discusses a video-recorded incident in which Oakland officers used batons on Occupy protester Kayvan Sebege on November 3rd. Warshaw revealed that the officer who first approached and struck Sebege had been issued a chest camera that could have captured better footage of the encounter, but had failed to wear it. Referring to another incident that night, Warshaw said that an Oakland officer had violated departmental policy when, without apparent warning, he shot protester Scott Campbell in the leg with a beanbag, an encounter that Campbell himself captured on video. The department faces another test Tuesday with Occupy protests. This was last beginning of the month, downtown. Last week, Jordan announced major reforms in crowd control in the same areas criticized by the Monitor. And that's, again, a story from the San Francisco Chronicle from May 1st. Oakland Police Monitor questions responses to Occupy. And there you go. And again, I'm looking over some of the other. There was another story that showed up again in the second section of the Chronicle a few days ago. Oakland panel weighs ban on protesters' tools, which provoked a lot of controversy. The Oakland City Council's Public Safety Committee will consider an ordinance today, Tuesday, I guess that's coming up, banning protesters from having tools of violence at demonstrations, including shields, poles, and hammers. Though the proposal from City Attorney Barbara Parker never refers to Occupy Oakland explicitly, it refers to dates on which the movement had several of its largest demonstrations. Among a host of incidents, Parker said vandals used a hammer to smash a window at a Whole Foods store November 2nd, sprayed graffiti throughout Frank Ogawa Plaza, that's Oscar Grant Plaza, for those of us who like it that way, on January 28th, and used fire accelerant on a police car on May 1st. On January 28th, when Occupy Oakland called a move-in day to take over the vacant Henry J. Kaiser Convention Center, and your reporter was there, though not in the center. Nobody was in the center. We were all being gassed on the sidewalk and then beaten later. Parker said people used shields made out of corrugated steel to advance on police lines and protect those who threw rocks and other objects at police, or perhaps defended those who were being wounded by police and tried to get them away, which is what I saw in the videos, although I was not at the front of the line when that stuff happened. To become law, the proposal would have to be approved by the Public Safety Committee on Tuesday, and ultimately would have to be approved by the full city council. The ordinance would make it a misdemeanor punishable with a $1,000 fine and 6 months in jail for having those items at a demonstration. The use of shields in particular has become an integral part of Occupy Oakland protest culture. At the November 2nd general strike, numerous masked protesters carried shields in the image of books, like Ursula K. Le Guin's The Dispossessed, as symbols of their cause, but also as protection from police. Of course, it's been done overseas for decades, like in Japan. Advocates say the shields have become essential, particularly since there have been a series of incidents of police using force that was later called into question. Protester Scott Olson suffered a fractured skull after he was shot with a beanbag by Oakland police, according to a federal monitor, not to mention a videotape. He has been filmed standing peacefully just moments before. Occupy protester Kayvan Sebege was hit repeatedly by an Oakland police officer wielding a baton, according to video footage. Another protester, Scott Campbell, was shot by a beanbag while he was filming police. All three incidents have raised concerns by a federal monitor tracking reforms in the Oakland PD. Police need protection from police, said Stephen Engel, 22, a member of Occupy Oakland. These shields have protected people from violence in the past. Police on May 1st shifted strategies on dealing with Occupy Oakland protests. Instead of mass tear gassing and attempts to corral large groups, small squads of officers went into the crowd and pulled out individuals for arrest on charges of committing crimes or violating stay-away orders. And I believe we had Abby Samuels, an activist up there, who was describing, as well as another woman, describing the way that operated. I could be mistaking Abby for another person here, but we did get reports about how police were essentially terrorizing people in the streets by running in and grabbing people on old warrants or for nothing at all, and breaking up the crowd into smaller groups, even when the crowd was simply engaging in peaceful protest. That was May 1st, the development of police tactics in America. At least 39 people were arrested. Police also went into the crowd throughout the day to remove shields, as though that's somehow the right of the police to remove a shield. Don't think so. Creating a list of banned items makes a much larger group of protesters subject to arrest, Angel said. It's a broader shift from trying to contain protests to preemptively stopping them, said Angel. Now it makes everybody part of that potential agitator group. Councilwoman Pat Kergenhan, a co-sponsor of the measure, said it was merely making protests safer for the majority. It looks like people are armed for battle, she said. I don't think that's what a protest march should be about. Well, I would suggest she tell that to the police, but I somehow think she probably was not too interested in that. Let's see if I have something else here. Again, I'm kind of reviewing the San Francisco Chronicle's website, which is sfgate.com. For those of you who want to waste your time with the San Francisco Chronicle, I seem to be one of those. And let's just see here. Well, here's another an example of showing the false charges that are being leveled against activists. Oakland Occupy Oakland activists escape hate crime charges May 22nd. That's, of course, the Chronicle's pro-police spin. They escape the hate crime charges, not expose hate crime charges as bogus. Alameda County prosecutors dropped robbery and hate crime charges Monday that they had filed against three Occupy Oakland demonstrators who got into an ugly altercation with a woman at a rally. The activists, Michael Davis, 33, and Ninka Crawford, 23, and 25-year-old Randolph Wilkins, had been scheduled to go on trial Monday. Instead, Crawford and Wilkins were cleared, while Davis pleaded guilty to misdemeanor vandalism in a separate case in which he was accused of using chalk to write disparaging comments about Oakland police inside a BART station. Wow, sounds like the Santa Cruz police going after people for chalking on the sidewalk political slogans. Anything to terrorize the folks into stopping the protest and intimidate the rest of the community from joining or supporting them. Deputy District Attorney Teresa Drenick, if you'll forgive my commentaries, said the dismissal was appropriate given Davis's plea deal, which calls for 3 years of probation in order for him to stay away from Oakland City Hall. Again, an attempt to break up protests by criminalizing people who are militants or leaders or activists. Davis's attorney, Yolanda Huang, who has called the case a political attack on Occupy Oakland, said she was gratified by the prosecutor's decision. It wasn't an appropriate use of public funds, and they recognize that. She said, I think the Oakland PD should stop manufacturing criminal charges and pay attention to genuine issues of public safety. And if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. At a preliminary hearing into the February 22nd altercation on Piedmont Avenue, prosecutors said Crawford had repeatedly called a woman who confronted protesters a dyke bitch as Davis grabbed her wallet. Defense attorney said the woman had been the aggressor and had herself used racial slurs. Wilkins had not been accused of using a slur or stealing from the woman, but prosecutors argued that he had pushed her around. And again, these are stories from Occupy Oakland recently in the last week, which are showing how the courts are not buying this bullshit. And similarly, our courts are not buying this bullshit, but that doesn't help the people whose jobs are on hold, who've lost their housing, who are losing their health, or who have even attempted suicide around these issues. Continuing my research, on-air research, your cub reporter here at work. I'm going to have to prove that in court, though. I'm going to have to bring in a fancy expert witnesses to prove that I am, in fact, a broadcaster and a reporter. Let's see. I think we may have exhausted the Occupy Oakland mainstream story. But I think I may want to turn out to more local stuff. You are tuned to, of course, the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz, and that is 101.3 if it were broadcasting, and can be obtained by going to TuneUp. If you look for it on your browser and then put in FRSC, which are our initials, our call letters, if you will. You can also call me in the studio with an update on whether I'm putting you to sleep with all this lengthy monologue and readings. I'm at 831-427-3772. 427-FRSC, off-air, 423-4833. If you want to find out what's happening with the Santa Cruz 11, that doughty band of we've been reduced to the Santa Cruz 7, really, but we still call ourselves the Santa Cruz 11. Bradley and Alex are still in there pitching for us, reporters reporting on the situation. The criminal arm of the conspiracy, as Rebecca Young likes to think of them. I think of them as being just reporters who are interested in these issues, and hell no, they're probably sympathetic. I mean, I would hope any decent person would be. In any case, I've written a story myself online about our Friday adventures in court, day before yesterday. Not a lot of excitement, and I kind of go on at length about it online. You can get it at, again, go to Santa Cruz Indy Media. It's the top story on the far right under local news called Visiting Judge Postpones Preliminary Due to DA Diddling and Bad Attorney Blues. And it's a story in the main page, too. Thank you very much, Indy Media. And for the first time ever, I wish to pat myself on the back. It's a story in the Santa Cruz 11 website, which is a good place to go if you want stuff that generally has excluded everything I've ever written, but now apparently is in desperation because nobody else has written anything, is posting my stuff. But actually, I mean, I know that what I say is often considered controversial by others. Some people don't like the way I put it. They think I'm too cutesy with my names or too harsh with my criticisms, and certainly I've been inaccurate with my facts on a couple of occasions and made corrections, but no, I'm not always right. So I'm one guy writing a series of updates, often at the last minute, so that can cause problems. But I'm glad to see that folks are at least looking over my stuff, and you can do it too. Again, www.santacruz11, spelled out 11, ALEVEN.org, is the official Santa Cruz 11 website. It doesn't mean it represents the opinion of all the 11 or a majority of the 11, but it is a place where people post stuff about the Santa Cruz 11 that is relevant to them and that supporters kind of agree should be posted. And so I'm really glad that I finally made the cut this time. That's nice. I have, however, written extensively about the Santa Cruz 11. If you want to find my stuff, go to indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz Indie Media, and just use the search function on that website for Norse, N-O-R-S-E. That's my last name. I'm also known as Robert Norris Kahn, for those who think I'm a cagey, conny kind of guy. But the update, the very brief update of what happened on Friday is that there were files were refiled against two of us. Well, there is actually a warrant outstanding now, as I understand it, or perhaps it's been recalled for Cameron Lorando. Angel Alcantara had a warrant suddenly issued for him, although he wasn't even aware that he had to appear in court. When he got into court, the warrant was withdrawn. We're all going to be going back to court a week from Friday, last Friday, next Friday. In other words, we're going in on June, I think it's 1st or 2nd, whenever that Friday is. And there will be a discussion of whether Attorney Young, and this was the key point, District Attorney Young, our prosecutor, our persecutor, our tormentor, our amateur torturer, has complied with the two judges' dictates that she cough up the discovery, that is to say, all the evidence that she claims shows how guilty we all are of felony conspiracies, how much we deserve to be subjected to 7 years in jail each. Which is horseshit, of course, so it's not really bearing much discussion. Similar to what's being done across the country, it's scare stuff. She wants people to plead to lesser charges, stay away from protests, stick your head in the sand, and so forth. And we're trying to support each other as best we can because some people are afraid that there's, you know, more evidence against them than others, in the sense that some people did occupy this building, it appears. I mean, they stayed there for 3 days. There was furniture brought in. You know, that's according to the videotapes that were shown by the news media. And it's, you know, to me, that's a public benefit. That's not a... You know. And but they, of course, they've got nobody doing any vandalism whatsoever. And that's, of course, the real issue if you want to find one at all. The real issue, of course, is how Wells Fargo gets away with this kind of crap, maintaining vacant structures downtown surrounded by barbed wire, supported by police, and at the same time daily engaging in ruining one family after another with a rip-off foreclosures. I mean, that's, of course, you know, the real issue. But it requires massive numbers of people. It doesn't require polite discussions to the Board of Supervisors. That, unfortunately, doesn't seem to do much good. Although, you know, that's all some people want to do. I say go and do it. It's certainly better than doing nothing. Just don't persuade yourself that you're engaging in truly meaningful action, which I think involves carrying things to a higher level. Anyway, on Friday, we had the judge found that the discovery had not been provided. It was supposed to have been provided on Monday. It was supposed to actually have been provided back in February. But Rebecca has had all kinds of problems. If you listen to her dog ate the homework list of excuses, she's the DA. And she has coughed up more discovery. Let's give her credit for that. She's coughed up hours of video, but not all the video. She's coughed up, she hasn't coughed up the free speech guidelines yet. There's numerous things she has not coughed up. And so there's going to be a conference next Friday to see where we're at. That means that the preliminary hearing, which was planned for five of us, and probably seven of us, if since Rebecca refiled against two people, judges threw out six of the 11 defendants immediately. Everybody has come to a preliminary hearing has had their charges thrown out. But this has made no difference to the infernal machine, and it continues to charge and recharge. Another thing that happened that was positive on Friday was that Brent Adams got an attorney appointed who is probably less likely to be as abusive and unresponsive as Brian Murphy, who is a sort of at the bottom of the toilet of the rogues gallery of attorneys. Oh, there probably is some are pretty or even worse, but he kind of took the cake. He had the effrontery to claim that he was not. He refused to separate himself from the case when Brent Adams asked him to, after Adams kept calling him and trying to get him to return calls, which he wouldn't do, talk to him. He dismissed all of Adams' stuff, demanded he plead guilty, saying he was foolish not to, blah, 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 blah. Which has nothing to do with either the merits of the case or the merits of the issue or how an attorney should act to a client. And I've also heard from a friend of Ryan Murphy's ex. Here we go, gossip time. That his ex didn't like him either. So, knee, 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 Brian Murphy. I don't know about him. I've never actually had much conversation. I don't think I've had any conversation with him. So, I'm taking all this from Brent Adams' accounts, which I think, well, I trust. He and I don't agree on all the issues. He's a big fan of Don Lane, our mayor, and I'm not. But when he describes the kind of conversations or lack of conversations he's had with his attorney Murphy, I tend to give that some credibility. So he has a new attorney, J.J. Hamlin, will be showing up on Friday. It looks like the attorneys are finally getting their shit together to actually talk to each other and recognize that this isn't just a bunch of individuals. This is a conspiracy against an entire movement by the police and the prosecution here in Santa Cruz. At least that's what I'm hoping, how it's going to be finally properly framed in the media, so we can get out from the framing that we are under, and a frame it is. So it's next Friday when the festivities continue, or the dirge goes on, for those who are interested. It's going to be Friday morning, I believe, at, and I never get these times right, I think it's 8:15 is what the indie media story says, and I assume they're quoting me correctly. So that's the deal there. I don't know what's happening with the case of Linda LeMaster. She's the Peace Camp 2010 person who's being dragged into the courts for illegal lodging because she had a sign on the steps of the county building about the right to sleep. Gary Johnson and Ed Fry have a similar problem. They're appealing a case, a six-month sentence each, and they go to, I guess, an appeal, three-judge appeal panel on the, I think it's the 14th of June, and I'll be talking more about that. Gary's been writing more online. Good for him. That's Ground Zero Gary Johnson. I've invited him to call the show. He actually has on occasion when he's not ranting at me for womanizing or something else. There's always a sort of an can be a prickly relationship between people who are part of this movement. But that because individuals who are a part of it often have very, very strong individual sentiments themselves. And some of them work well in groups, others don't. Presumably they don't work as well as they could have because they'd be in politics otherwise. Thank God they're not. Also upcoming, if I will check my notes, is... let's see here. The appeals documents for Gary Johnson and Ed Fry, who are really early precursors to the Occupy movement and part of a long tradition of civil disobedience and simply trying to assert First Amendment rights to expose the city's come to Santa Cruz homeless face hell on wheels in spite of the completely bogus claims of Take Back Santa Cruz and the bullshit being dished out by the Sentinel and the Coonerty majority on the city council that somehow need more protection against the homeless murderers, you know, the homeless people with criminal records. Gary and Ed are part of a long, peaceful tradition, and there is recent documents they've posted on their website. There are two websites to go to. One is peacecamp2010insider.blogspot.com, peacecamp2010insider.blogspot.com, and there's also Ed Fry's own website, fullspectrumdemocracy.org, fullspectrumdemocracy.org. I often mock Ed's proposals because I don't agree with him about full-spectrum democracy. He wants to see regular meetings by lot between public officials and constituents, which, you know, isn't a bad idea, but it's too token, too limited, and it's certainly no panacea in my view. But he is a man who wants desperately and determinedly and put his whole heart behind public transparency, public accountability, and public justice. And there's just no there's no getting around that. He's also an attorney. He'll come to your aid if he can, even as his own life goes under. He defended Chris Doyen, the Commander X activist who worked so hard at Peace Camp 2010 and so successfully at publicizing it. Christopher Doyen did. Curb Hugger Chris, as I call him, for those of you who remember him on the air. And he now faces Ed Fry, his attorney, faces big fines and court sanctions for Doyen's flight. Doyen is reportedly in Canada, giving interviews around the globe and all that sort of thing. I'm of mixed mind about Chris's publicity approach on that. There's some who fervently defend him, others who just as fervently denounce him. I got a little of this and a little of that for him. He's, you know, he regards himself as a revolutionary, it appears, and revolutionaries don't necessarily want to spend a lot of time in jail if they can avoid it. They'd rather be out there talking to the people and making revolution. And I can understand that. On the other hand, they have responsibility to those who they leave behind, and I also understand that. So it's a mixed bag. There's the Davis Dozen and the Sproul 13. I believe these are other groups, kind of like the Santa Cruz 11, who have come together because they have been falsely charged by authorities. And again, I haven't investigated them really closely, but that's my guess. And I'll probably be researching them more as time goes on. One thing I wanted to do on this show, though, has to do with following up. Oh, here's something. Before we do that, I was going to follow up on the hysteria against the homeless based upon the murder of Collins, of the camouflage owner. But here's another quickie. Charges dismissed against the Ice Cream 3. And actually, I think I read about that. Those are the three who were accused of... assault and theft and the stuff that was all dismissed because it was actually just police going after Occupy activists. There are a couple of other things before I go into the, you know, my local diss of Monica Martinez, Don Lane, the city council, which is kind of tiresome to have to repeat, but probably does bear repeating. There are a couple of updates. 25th of May on Friday, federal prosecutors then urged a judge to lift her order barring enforcement of part of the infamous National Defense Authorization Act, the law that makes indefinite detention the explicit rule of the land at the discretion of the Führer, by which we mean the president, of course, or one of his advisors, whoever he's listening to at the moment. The judge throughout that entire section, a local judge, a very courageous local judge, Catherine Forrest, remember that name. Manhattan federal judge Catherine Forrest this month ruled in favor of activists and reporters who said they feared being detained under a section of the law signed by Führer Obama in December. I like to give him his proper title, for those who are wondering. It's not in the original story. The judge's preliminary injunction bars the government from enforcing Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act's Homeland Battlefield provisions. This section authorizes indefinite military detention for those detained who have, quote, substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or, quote, associated forces, unquote. A U.S. sailor is the 3,000th Afghanistan war death. U.S. sailor who died last week of medical complications, according to this website, which is it's called the CDG website. I think I've seen this story is confirmed elsewhere, so I will simply continue to read. According to CNN's count, based on information provided by the U.S. Defense Department and the International Security Assistance Force, Petty Officer First Class Ryan J. Wilson of Shasta, California, died May 20th in Mahani, Bahrain. The Defense Department reported in an email sent Friday. He was assigned to the U.S. Naval Forces Central Command in Bahrain, supporting the Afghanistan mission, the email said. So now, of course, we're going to hear how, what a Memorial Day weekend, we should all go out there and mourn for all these dead soldiers, sailors, Marines, and other murderers who have been occupying foreign countries or just shooting missiles at them from a distance. You know, I had a little cold moment when I went into court on Friday because the two deputies at the metal detector, which is this huge megalith of a machine that people are supposed to go through for alleged security reasons, which is complete horseshit in my view, and a monstrous and regular and ill-advised violation of our privacy. He's a guy, I wouldn't call him friendly with me, but he's sort of has a grudging respect for me, which I think he lost, because he said to me, was I ever in the service? And I turned to him and I said, you mean, did I ever kill any? I think I said, no, I didn't. And he said, oh. I said, why? Did you ever murder any people while you were overseas in the service yourself, deputy? Putting it rather baldly, I must say. And he then, you know, withdrew and wouldn't say anything and harumphed. And he was obviously rather deeply offended. But, you know, you got to be prepared to deal with those kinds of offenses, I think, if you're going to say what's going on. And I don't think it's, as I said many a time on this show, any benefit or any service to this community to treat killers as heroes. Nor is it appropriate to blame them in the sense that once they're veterans, they certainly deserve some rehabilitation and support, and they aren't getting it. And many substantial minority of the homeless are veterans. And, you know, they've gotten the shaft too. But we got to be really careful about jumping on this flaggy bandwagon, and I constantly want to bring that up. Another story here. Propaganda firm owner admits attacks on journalists. The co-owner of a major Pentagon propaganda contractor publicly admitted Thursday that he was behind a series of websites used in an attempt to discredit two USA Today journalists. Wow, I must be getting pretty desperate. I thought USA Today discredited itself quite usually, but who had reported on the contractor. The online misinformation campaign, first reported last month, has raised questions about whether the Pentagon or its contractors had turned its propaganda operations against U.S. citizens. But Camille Shediac, minority owner of Lyon Industries and its former president, said he was responsible for the online activity and was operating independently of the company and the Pentagon. Not quite sure I follow all of that. 70 reports of police misconduct on Sunday at the NATO protests, says the National Lawyers Guild, 23rd of May. That was last weekend, protest against NATO in Chicago. What is the legacy of the massive Sunday protests that brought out an estimated 15,000 people? One lasting effect on both the city and protesters is how the Chicago Police Department behaved over the much-hyped weekend. According to Sarah Gelsomino with the National Lawyers Guild and the People's Law Office, the NLG received 70 separate claims of police misconduct from Sunday's events. The majority of those incidents are baton strikes to the head and face, said Getsamino. We saw broken collarbones, broken arms, teeth knocked out, heads bashed in, lips busted, and a number of concussions. And here's an article of Property and Propaganda, which I'd like to read. I'm going to make it a little easier for me to look at, though. Let's see here. This is by Rob Urie, and it comes originally from the Counterpunch website. Renewed criticism of black bloc anarchists ties in a tangential way to the arrest of terrorism charges of three youths in Chicago prior to recent anti-NATO protests. The anarchists raised the question of the legitimate use of violence to achieve political ends. The arrest of the youths on trumped-up charges with what credible sources, the National Lawyers Guild, believe is manufactured evidence suggests that as far as the state is concerned, they're going to make up the charges anyway, so what is the difference? Terrorism charges have long been used for political repression because they are premised on the legitimacy of state violence versus the illegitimacy of non-state violence. But the question of legitimacy was in fair measure the reason why anti-NATO protesters were in Chicago. Member states claim the right through NATO to commit political violence at will. The protesters, rightly in my view, counter that, one, the reasons given by NATO for committing violence are lies intended to deceive populations into supporting armed aggression, and two, were the real reasons for NATO violence given, they would be deemed illegitimate, and therefore the violence itself is illegitimate. Criticism of black bloc tends to center around public relations. The fear the media will focus on property damage to the exclusion of the protesters' broader message. But the dominant media in the U.S. are corporations that have demonstrated that they will promote a broad corporatist agenda at all costs. The Chicago Police Department and the coordinated state security apparatus understand this, and they are using terrorism charges as propaganda to try to draw a line between protesters and the growing millions of disenfranchised citizens. The state knows from experience that when it comes to terrorism, the dominant corporate media will report what the state tells it, most probably with more sensationalism than the state could hope for. So to all those worried that black bloc generates bad publicity, the government media line is all bullshit all the time anyway. And the black bloc neither causes nor will polite behavior by protesters produce favorable media treatment, particularly if protests begin to become politically effective. To the issue of property damage, this is a right-wing canard. Were the state and media interested in property damage, we have Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Here at home, we have millions of empty houses and destroyed neighborhoods thanks to specific actionable crimes committed by specific banks and bankers that the government is protecting. Then there is the world-threatening environmental damage produced by specific corporate actors that are also being protected by the government. So to black bloc critics worried about property damage, ending state violence by asking politely that the state stop committing it, runs into the paradox that the state is using political violence to crack open the heads of protesters who are politely asking that same state to stop committing political violence. State violence deemed illegitimate calls into question the very premise of terror charges. If state violence is not in all circumstances legitimate, then how can non-state violence to end illegitimate state violence in all circumstances be illegitimate? The state's public position articulated by recent presidents is that protesters have every right to peacefully protest the use of illegitimate violence by the state. But, as a purveyor of illegitimate violence, what right does the state retain to claim that legitimately distinguishes state from non-state violence? The state is, in effect, is either forced into the profoundly undemocratic position that its legitimacy is self-generated, and therefore not a function of the consent of the people, or that its legitimacy does derive from the consent of the people, and therefore, when that consent is withdrawn, so is the state's legitimacy. The issue of consent, or rather its absence, gets to the very heart of the protesters' criticism of NATO. If the U.S. state, under the guise of NATO, the Coalition of the Willing, or any other umbrella group, actively deceives the public to gain support for acts of political violence, then in what sense can consent be said to have been given? And if consent hasn't been given, in what sense is the state violence legitimate? Finally, if state violence isn't legitimate under its own legal premises, then neither are the terrorism charges. So on to black bloc. The anarchist inclination toward radical democracy has resonance across social political movements that have arisen in recent years. So, in the most fundamental sense, there is at this level general agreement amongst us. The difference seems to be one of tactics. Was there a playbook, a guide to successfully creating social and political change? It would also be in the hands of those who oppose change. No one of us knows where collective political action will take us. My suggestion is that inclusion is better than exclusion, particularly when there is, at some level, a coincidence of interests. The state and corporate media will make up any lies they deem necessary to shut effective political opposition down. However, the disenfranchisement that leads to political opposition to the plutocratic state is factually a product of the plutocrats and their servants in government, and not the protesters. That is to say, the forces of effective propaganda are on the side of the state, but the facts of political, economic, and social disenfranchisement are with the forces of change. And the facts will ultimately determine if the change will come, and not the turgid nonsense put out by the corporate media. Property will come and go. As long as black bloc is on the side of the people, they have a place. Rob Ury is an artist and political economist in New York, and that is a story of Property and Propaganda, Black Bloc Anarchists, and State Terrorism. You can find it on the Counterpunch website. And I think right now I'm going to play a little music and give you a chance to flood me with your phone calls and reactions. 427-3772. So don't be shy.
Stand up and walk out on me. Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how do I? Tell me, don't you say it no more. All the time, yeah.
What do you see when you turn out the light?
I can't tell you, but it sure feels like mad. Don't you know I'm gonna make it with my friends? I promised myself I'd get by. Said I'm gonna try it with a true heart. Yeah.
up in the morning, out on the job, work like the devil for my pay. And the lucky old son ain't got nothing to do but roll around heaven all day. Fuss with my woman, toil for my kids, sweat till I'm wrinkled and gray. But the lucky old son ain't got nothing to do but roll around heaven all day. Lord above, can't you see I'm crying? Tears are in my eyes. Send down a cloud with a silver lining. Take me to paradise. Show me that river. Lead me across. Take all my troubles away. And like the lucky old son, I'll have nothing to do but roll around heaven all day. And like the lucky old son, I'll have nothing to do but roll around heaven all day.
Well, one of those was Willie Nelson, and the other one was a Beatles tune by somebody else. So, hey there. I just had a quick chat with Linda LeMaster. She's the chair of the former Homeless Issues Task Force, longtime homeless activist, and she has her own blog, Hearth by Linda, if you want to check it out. She and Steve Plaich, who is a Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project worker, have actually gotten the Sent Anal to publish one of their opinion pieces today. You can find it online, or if you want to waste money, you can buy the paper, the Sunday paper. Their article is Homeless Must Not Be Scapegoated. And it's a little too mild for my taste, but it's in response to the cut off the funds, check out their police records, only serve the local homeless, dump them somewhere else, give them tickets out of town, stuff that's coming through the city council, being led by the torches and pitchforks of the Take Back Santa Cruz mob, masquerading as public safety, which I don't go for much. And they, and after the murder of Shannon Collins, of course, we don't know much about the murder of the other activists. Josh, the guy who got hit and run on his bike. But, you know, hey, they were just homeless people. And if a merchant gets killed, hey, now there's an opportunity to really beat the drums. So I've talked about this before. I went through the points at length in the Sentinel letter. What I didn't do, though, is I didn't... I don't know if I should read this editorial because... One, it's really not my style. And it's a very kind of a tempered statement. We're very sad. Well, a little bit of it. No words can describe the depth of sadness we feel as a community over the recent and shocking murder of Shannon Collins, which took place midday in a Santa Cruz neighborhood. How can we best, while sharing our grief and despite our differences, respond to such a senseless tragedy in ways that reflect the true measure of our community? See, I'd stop right here and say... unless I knew this woman, I don't really feel there is any appropriate way to respond to a random killing. I mean, I'd look at the figures in the neighborhood and say, is murder going up for some reason? Is there a gang of armed thugs? And I guess that's to some extent the fantasy that Take Back Santa Cruz and Santa Cruz neighbors and the, or is pursuing and the city council to blame a group homeless people as though they are somehow any more violent than any other group and is somehow any kind of connection, which there isn't. But it's so obviously bogus that it's, you know, I mean, so anyway, I just think that addressing this whole thing is, you really got to deal with public safety and mental illness issues, maybe, although I guess I always turn back to the issues that are going to be daily confronting homeless people, survival issues, that homeless people and that ordinary people in houses do not have the same dimension of need. They just don't. And it's just, you know, you can play all this superior I'm working and you're not kind of bullshit all you want, or, you know, I worked hard and, you know, or I for my money and now I've, you know, I've got a little bit here and I'm struggling to hold it as Wells Fargo dumps my money and gets bailed out by more of my taxes. But in fact, you're in a really different situation than you are if you're on the streets. And to go after people who are on the streets in a situation where there is continued criminalization of poor and homeless people, who are actually, I think, a benefit to the community by being eyes on the street. I continue to believe in Becky Johnson's argument, another homeless activist I have a lot of respect for in that regard. But instead, onward with this editorial. Linda and Steve continue writing. In solidarity with our neighbors, we are speaking from our heartfelt concern about a generally anti-homeless policy package that would now attach itself to our grief, to our collective fears, and to our rightful rage. And there's discussion of that. Again, generality discussion of the homeless package and what the real situation with homeless people is. 67% of people are homeless in our streets, either grew up here or were formerly established residents. Adult homeless men, both by personal choice and exclusive policies, are dying 25 to 35 years prematurely. There's no mention here that there's been a shelter emergency in Santa Cruz for 20 years, and the response of the city of the shelter emergency has generally been make them criminals. And or if you have to deal with the courts protecting their rights, trying to splice together laws that still make them criminals and still give the police as much power as possible to harass, detain, search, and so forth, in ways that have nothing to do with saving anybody like Shannon Collins. Or Josh, for that matter. And so it's the issue for me has to do with how people are being treated generally in ways we can control. And that is issues that, of course, the people who are pushing this anti-homeless agenda, and I have a much different opinion. And, of course, Steve and Linda and I are all on the same team on this. We all tend to agree. It's just we emphasize different things. Let us not make dicey tensions morph into a greater conflict. Rather, let's work more closely with our neighbors, all housed, homeless, transitioning students, even our guests. Restoring and creating a better community can include every one of us, and we can develop policies that could actually generate greater safety and human dignity. We all, including homeless human beings, deserve this. We can lead with compassion and hang on to the notion that every human being deserves dignity. We are offering community engagement rather than a widened divide. Civic safety must include everyone. And again, at a time when our community is most in need of strong, creative, compassionate leadership, an ad hoc committee of three Santa Cruz City Council members presents a slate of new policies and regulations that echo the fear and anger many in our community share. Taken together, their package affords none of the depth of reason and cooperation we sorely need in this dark hour. These proposals would prove by turns to be harmful, impractical, and arguably unlawful. If the city of Santa Cruz needs to suppress needed emergency sheltering for which it shares responsibility, or to divert city funding to manipulate trafficking of homeless people through our city as if they were a subclass or even a subspecies, it behooves everyone, including the city attorney, to create a less reactive and more inclusive approach beforehand. It seems to be an awfully gobbledygooky way of saying, let's find a better way of tracking those homeless criminals. And I asked last week, or was it on Thursday, okay, you're going to have a registry of everybody in a house, too, because there are a hell of a lot more of them, and there's no indication that the crime rate is necessarily any greater. At least if that's the case, I haven't seen it. I haven't examined it either. I got to be honest about that. But I would assume that Take Back Santa Cruz, as I said before, and other NIMBY vigilante groups would be ranting about it at the top of their lungs, or at least mentioning it in their columns and in their little commentaries. Linda LeMaster and Steve Plaich continue. We feel the agenda of this ad hoc group promises limited safety. Limited safety? It's not pushing it even that far. Why would it be any safer? While ensuring greater fear, an expanded underground economy that will touch all of us, and increased criminalization of uprooted folks that will waste even more court, jail, and other staffing resources. Collaborating with the county's mental health resources is already legally required of the city, and focused civic leadership is long overdue, as is restoring funds for an existing homeless resource officer within the Santa Cruz Police Department. And that is a bunch of horse shit, as far as I'm concerned. Homeless resource officer, formerly Eric Seeley, has nothing to do with real homeless resources. He's the police eyes on the homeless community rather than an attempt to address real problems of real people, even public safety problems that homeless people have. That's been my general understanding of Seeley, although there are those who take a different view. We all know there are problems with the system, that there is a large transient population in our city, and that the Santa Cruz has its issues, shared Ken Vinson in a courageous public statement right after his wife and his best friend was suddenly tragically killed. But I want to be very clear about one thing. None of these things caused this horrific crime, a single individual did. And again, yeah. I don't know. Restating the obvious to me instead of talking about getting back to what the real agenda is is giving fuel to the fire, acting as though it's a real issue to consider these bogus public safety rants and raves. And I just don't think so. Linda's editorial is online. And Linda and Steve, there are some comments underneath it. Let's see what kind of critiques she gets. Every human being deserves dignity is responded to by an anonymous poster who says, only to the extent that said human beings extend that same dignity towards others. Sadly and tragically, that doesn't appear to be the case with the transient, chronic homeless situation presently being witnessed in Santa Cruz. In other words, them dirty, scummy homeless don't deserve human rights. If Linda and Steve took a hike or a bike ride on the levee on Saturday or Sunday afternoon, they could feel the love of the homeless community as I have. We don't want this here. Pretty nasty comments. So these are... I'm attacking poor Steve and Linda from the left, and these folks are attacking them from the bigoted side of the road. But there's a couple of praising comments praising this particular editorial. It's a Sunday editorial again. The Sentinel, homeless must not be scapegoated. And the answer is, it's just stupid for people who think that's the public safety issue. It's not a public safety issue. That's why it's so disingenuous. It has nothing to do with public safety. It has to do with people wanting to clear out a class of people they don't like the look of. And that they're nervous and their fears that they may join them is another thing. So, and their sense that they're feeling insecure about the economy and other things, and so let's blame this group of people that looks pretty scruffy and grubby and is shooting up in the bushes instead of shooting up behind closed doors. And I'm not suggesting in any way that your average homeless person is an addict, but I'm taking even the grimmest part of that stereotype and suggesting that it's not the public safety issue. Taking action like dealing with providing needle exchange is dealing with a public safety issue. And that's what I think these folks should be paying more attention to. I did get a letter from the former director of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, who I've had both agreements and disagreements with. He has some pretty strong sentiments about this proposal. I'm going to, and I believe I have his permission to read them on the air. I'm going to do that. I'd actually hope to have him call in at some point, and I perhaps will. Here it is. Let's take a look. He writes, "Hi, Robert. I am really surprised how blatantly the City Council and the Homeless Services Center are discriminating against targeting the homeless population. There is no innocent until proven guilty here. They're taking a group of individuals and profiling them on the basis of living arrangements and income. It is a clear attempt to segregate and excommunicate a group of persons according to social status and remove them from the community. I wonder if they are going to implement an income cutoff for Santa Cruz. I think these proposals are just banter to give the illusion the City Council and the Homeless Service Center is on top of the problem." And he then has some specific comments. Coonerty, Robinson, Bryant, and Monica Martinez announced a series of policy proposals following the murder. Quote, "We believe these proposals to be common sense and easily implemented. They reflect the conversations we've had with the police, social service providers, and concerned citizens. None of these proposals, if in and of themselves, would have stopped Charles Edwards, who they regard as the chief suspect, if not the out of court, but he hasn't been proven perp murderer. But if adopted, these approaches will bring accountability and targeted resources to the challenges facing our community." To which Doug Loisel responds, "I would think that someone from the homeless community should have been present in these discussions. It is concerning the homeless. It is concerning that the homeless don't have a voice in any of these discussions. Where is the dialogue with homeless persons?" This is an important thing that nobody's mentioned, including myself. Thank you, Doug. "The proposals are, this year's future budget allocation to homeless services will require implementation of an ID system, a registry protocol currently used in Santa Cruz motels to give police and service providers a better sense of who is using the facility, and rules that prioritize services for residents of Santa Cruz County over people from outside the area, with the exception of the winter emergency shelter and victims of domestic violence who are in imminent danger." And Loisel's response to the identification system is, "So people are going to be identified and monitored on the basis of income. So is this going to be for all low-income persons in Santa Cruz or just those seeking shelter? Is this same system going to be set up at WIC? I'm not quite sure what WIC is. I think it's the food program. And other homeless shelters and Social Security offices. It's unclear what this will actually accomplish. In response to a registry protocol used in to give Santa Cruz motels, police and service providers a better sense of who's using the facility. So once the homeless person is identified and placed on a registry, then what? And finally, rules that prioritize services for residents locally." He doesn't have any problem with that. Second proposal. "The city designate a police officer to meet regularly with the Homeless Services Center to identify homeless individuals who are engaging in criminal behavior and coordinate actions." Loisel says, "Wouldn't staff at the Homeless Services Center already be reporting criminal activity? What actions will be taken? Are the police going to set up sting operations at the Homeless Services Center? Third, we as council members will not support any new homeless service facilities in the city of Santa Cruz." I guess they want more sports stadiums. "We believe that other jurisdictions in Santa Cruz County need to share equally in the costs." And Loisel says, "This is up to the city council and the city council's priorities." Fourth, we as council members will work with property owners of public housing to screen current and prospective tenants for serious criminal history. And Loisel says, "This is up to the providers of public housing, but it doesn't really have anything to do with the homeless population." Again, it smacks me as a kind of a surveillance that's not particularly helpful. Five, we are partnering with the county to continue and expand funding for mental health outreach workers. And Loisel agrees with this. This is a good thing and should continue. Six, the City and Homeless Services Center will expand the Homeward Bound program using San Francisco's successful model to provide more bus tickets to homeless individuals to return to communities where they have a support system. Below is the criteria for the San Francisco Homeward Bound program, to which Loisel writes, Homeward Bound is a voluntary program. You must be homeless, living in San Francisco. You must be medically stable enough to travel to the destination. You must not have any outstanding warrants or other legal problems. You must have a place, and he emphasizes that. You must have a place to reside at the destination, and there is ample support. Clients who receive these requirements will receive a bus ticket home. I'm in agreement with this program. If homeless persons want to return home to their communities, this is a good opportunity. The only problem is that you will be sending the good homeless home, since it appears they cannot have a criminal record to take advantage of this program. Also, there's request number 7, is the county jail return their prisoners to their community of origin upon completion of their sentence. Lozell has nothing to say about this. And finally, we will ask our judicial system to provide a monthly list of offenders, sort of like in the stocks, who have failed to appear in court so that the city attorney can prosecute them under the city's repeat offender law. You know, sitting twice on the sidewalk next to a building, that sort of thing. Once again, as with number 2, shouldn't they already be doing this? So how is law enforcement, Doug Loisel asks, going to track down these people, and what will they do with them once they are caught? Are they going to be placed in jail, and what will be the community that will absorb the incredibly high cost of incarcerating people? Usually the homeless people have nuisance violations such as loitering or trespassing. Are these folks going to be placed in jail? He concludes, these are clearly politically motivated proposals and not a serious response to the problems facing Santa Cruz. These proposals will not make the community safer, nor will they improve the living conditions of those persons without shelter. Why would the Homeless Service Center want to send the homeless out of Santa Cruz? And that, again, is a letter from Doug Loisel, former director of the Homeless Services Center, or lack of services center, as I so characterize it. And we're reaching toward the end of the show. I think what I'm going to do here is play an interview with Glenn Greenwald and see what you think. Glenn Greenwald is a writer for Salon.com, who's done a lot of critiquing of the national security crap, or I should say the assassinations are us stuff that Obama has been putting out and his Democratic Party hacks have been suggesting is necessary to deal with the tough-on-terrorism threat, or let's say rip the Constitution into smaller shreds. There's an incoming call, but I don't think we have a working line. Let's see. Are you there, caller?
Yes, I am. It's your intrepid reporter, Steve Plage.
Hey, Steve, it says the line isn't working, but I guess it is. You suddenly magically touched our phone line. Steve, have you been listening?
I have that effect wherever I go.
You haven't been listening to the show, of course. You never do, right?
Well, pardon me. I'm doing an ill exchange, so we don't have it bright yet.
I don't want to hear your health pretext, Plage. I just read
a
part.
It's a public health issue. I'm telling you, it's a public health issue.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you know, we just listened to me read your and Linda LeMaster's Sunday editorial.
Was it in the paper?
It is in the paper, Fluff and Puff, but nonetheless.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, because Linda sent me an email this morning saying that she was looking online and couldn't find it.
Yeah, she's wrong. It's both online and in the paper. And
she was just mistaken. You don't be so harsh with Linda. You said she was wrong.
Not,
it's not, you know, don't. No,
wrong on this issue,
too critical.
Wrong, but not wrong-headed.
No, of course not. Well intentioned.
Yes. She's not feeling well, by the way, so people should send out their best wishes
for her. Yeah,
she's
got a little pink eye problem going. So
it's gotten worse. Apparently it's something else now, so it's really bad.
We send out our best to her always.
But I think she may be listening to the show, and I've done a read-through of your article pretty much with my usual pungent, why are they being so soft and so fluffy? But, you know, I know that you are trying to be very judicious in your comments.
Well, you know, and that's one of the things I really wanted to call in about. I was going to suggest that we at some point, either Linda, yourself, or me, or somebody, actually challenge the three council members to a debate on these proposed policies. I think that would be good for the entire community. So maybe that's something we can follow up on.
Well, you know, I'm already going to suggest, I've invited Don Lane, our mayor, to come back and debate these issues, since he doesn't seem to be having much.
But unfortunately, they're not his policies, and I think he's kind of on the fence. about a couple of them. I'd love to have maybe Lynn or Hillary or Ryan even, you know, engage in some, you know, public debate about the proposed policies, and we could have a full airing of them. I think it would be fantastic.
When pigs fly is my suggestion. Yeah, they aren't going to do that. But, you know, they don't have to. They run things anyway, so why should they talk to an upstart like yourself, not to mention a pariah like me?
Well, you know what I've been saying all day. I say free Robert Norris.
No, that's the first time I've heard that, actually.
Free Becky Johnson.
There you go. That's your perennial refrain. I've actually already talked about the Santa Cruz 11. We're listening now to Steve Plaich, who is an activist with the only activist with the Homeless Persons Legal Project, as well as a long-term stalwart, fairly long-term, for needle exchange and suicide prevention, and a shitty council candidate. Steve, how goes the campaign?
Well, we're not going to be cranking anything up until after the primary, which is a week from Tuesday, kind of clear the field, and then we start to put out some signs and raising some money and talking to some folks. I'm looking forward to it, but between now and then, there's really a lot to do, you know, kind of get ourselves organized. As you know, I'm sure that you mentioned that next Friday is a pretty important hearing for the Santa Cruz 11 to kind of see which way the wind is going to be blowing on some of this stuff, so I think, you know, that we'll keep our focus on the Santa Cruz 11 for right now, and then the campaign will take its course, you know, when the time is right. But probably not for another week or two until after the primary.
Well, I know that, and I've talked a bit about the last Friday's hearing, and actually next Friday may not be that enlightening, except he's going to, you know, set a time for a preliminary hearing, I suppose. Or maybe, you know, maybe
well,
Rebecca Young
important,
will.
It's important for Brendan, you know, because he'll be there, you know, determining whether he wants to accept J.J. Conlon as his counsel. And I know Brendan has so much problem with representation that it's certainly a crucial hearing for him.
Well, you know, I think one of the problems, of course, is Brent's do-nothing attorney, Ryan Murphy, but another one of his problems, I know you hate it when I criticize attorneys, but I have to occasionally speak out, in fact, regularly speak out.
I respect you. I always respect your point of view, although I may respectfully disagree.
Indeed. You sometimes have a very disrespectful way of showing your disagreement, but that's okay. You know,
I'm on my best behavior.
No, that's
beautiful
okay.
Man, Santa Cruz.
You behave as you feel.
So,
you
go now, so complete your point.
Sure. I think we have beginning to have a consortium of attorneys who are actually talking with each other, mainly because they were forced to, because they all had to come to the same court hearing. It's kind of disgusting that takes that kind of process to get these clowns together. But the fact is that I'm glad they are getting together. We also have some out-of-town attorneys who are getting paid a fat sum to get some shit going up around motions like selective enforcement, which we actually had initially been proposed by attorneys for Alex DeRosi and Bradley Allen, but didn't see the light of day really because the judge said, we don't have to go into selective enforcement. There's inadequate evidence here. Goodbye,
right.
Rebecca Young, you know, on these cases.
Yeah.
You know, so that I think that Brent is going to have an easier time of it for a couple of reasons. One, J.J. Hamlin, I suspect, even though I made some questionable comments about him when I spoke to you a couple days ago, is still, I think, a much, you know, he's, when bolstered by other attorneys, if they're working in concert in some sense,
right.
I think they're likely to come up with some more, you know, stronger stuff.
You know, and even though the Judge Briggs did not reach the question of selective enforcement or selective prosecution when he dismissed Alex and Bradley, nevertheless, that motion still is well taken, I think, in your case, certainly with Brent. And some of the other defendants. So, you know, were I strategizing in concert individually as an attorney for any of the 11, I would certainly concentrate on that and use that kind of as a template because that was very good to pay for it. They drafted the court simply just didn't reach the question because they didn't need to.
And for those who don't know, the Santa Cruz 11 are charged with a bunch of felonies and misdemeanors, essentially as part of, the national attack on Occupy generally, which is in miniature happening here and happening in other cities, to try to deter protesters from challenging established authorities and established economic institutions in ways
And yet we will not be deterred. We will stand strong. Stand together. Stand in solidarity.
I hope so. I will be probably not standing in solidarity. I will be delivering care packages to poor Linda Lemaster at her house.
Oh, my. Yeah, well, please do that.
And I'll be going to my own room to collapse in a heap.
Yeah.
These prosecutions take their toll on people, I got to tell you. I'm apparently,
no question.
You know,
I'm going to have to get back to my needle exchange, but
before
we'll
you do, Steve, there is a desal issue that was mentioned on the internet. There is apparently some developments in that field. The desal is coming.
It looks like we're going to be able to qualify our charter amendment, so we'll be delivering our signatures to the city clerk on Tuesday morning.
This is an amendment. Tell people to do what again?
Anybody who's a registered voter in the city of Santa Cruz can certainly sign the petitions that are still going around.
No, explain what it is. Explain what it is to those who don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. What we are proposing is a charter amendment that would guarantee the people in Santa Cruz the right to vote on whether or not to construct the desalination plant when they are ready to build it.
At a cost of?
Well, it costs about $130 million, and that really doesn't include operating maintenance costs. They've spent about $15 million already, and we can't do anything about that. But we can present to the voters an opportunity to decide whether or not they think that pursuing a desal plant is wise and in their best interest when the plant is ready to be constructed, and that is when they've completed all their CEQA requirements and environmental impact reports and coastal commission permits and things like that. Those things will still proceed, but when the project is what we call shovel-ready, put a shovel in the ground, then we're guaranteeing the voters in Santa Cruz the right to say, you know, we think this is a good idea, and let's go ahead and build it, or no, we think desal alternatives or a greater emphasis on conservation or more commitment to, you know, any range of options is the better path to take. So we're guaranteeing them the right to vote. As you know, the city council tried to short-circuit our efforts by passing an ordinance themselves. Ostensibly gives the voters the right to decide when the project is ready to go. Of course, the future councils are not bound by the decisions of this council.
Right.
So the only way to guarantee the right to vote is through a charter amendment, and that's what we're going to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, this
ballot.
Council isn't bound by the decisions of this council either, for that matter, you know.
I do have to go, but I will tell you that the Occupy GA is at 2 o'clock, so we'll be making an announcement about our continuing support for the Santa Cruz 11 and the working group that meets at 3 o'clock at the Sub Rose every Monday, and even including holidays.
Any events coming up this weekend? Next week?
Oh, well, yeah. There's an English change today, of course. Then there's the GA. We'll still be gathering signatures tomorrow. It's pretty much I've got to give over to gathering the last few signatures for me.
How can people help?
But then, if anybody sees me around town or any, we have some paid petition gatherers and many, many, many volunteers. If they see anybody out that has a desal petition and they're registered voter in the city of Santa Cruz, please sign that. And, of course, tomorrow there's the Red Church meal, of course. There's also the ACLU board meeting, which I'm understanding Bob LaMonica is going to be attending.
That's at 7 o'clock at the Loudoun Nelson Center?
No, Loudoun Nelson is closed. It'll be at the courthouse conference room right behind the city council.
Oh, the courtyard council room.
Right, yeah, the courtyard conference
room. Near the council chambers, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. We'll be submitting our signatures on Tuesday. Then Wednesday, of course, the Festival del Nopal will be meeting with my great and good friend, Tony Madrigal. So there's stuff going on, but hopefully we will see you a little later on the boulevard.
Indeed, I'd like to have you longer because I know there are other things I'd like to talk to you about, but you don't want those needles not to be exchanged. Or is it
absolutely
suicide not to be prevented?
Absolutely. Keep them off the streets and in our biohazard containers. So anyway, solidarity and justice for the Santa Cruz 11.
Hey, thanks for your work, Steve.
Talk care.
Keep it up, man.
Talk to you later. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And actually, an incoming phone call. What an amazing thing. That's the first phone call of the morning. This keeps up. I won't have to come in for the next few weeks. I'll just pick up the calls on the answering machine and answer them later. You can reach me off air at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Apparently, the 469-3119 line is working. My goodness. I'll have to take down this sign because that seems to be outdated. For heaven's sake. Yeah, I believe there was a meeting last week of the Racial Justice Police Brutality Monitoring Group that started out several years ago under Tony Madrigal, councilperson, and I think Mark Halfman might have been involved, or I could be thinking of other folks. It collapsed into a series of just meetings that didn't really... They took complaints, but complaints never went anywhere, and that was too bad. It has a long name, and I hope they are more successful what they're doing. Let's see if it's, I can actually find that actual name in the Santa Cruz Indie Media website, although I don't even think they post there. So, but let's see. Looking on the calendar section, which is a helpful place to go for on occasion. Let's see here. Previous week. No, I think I must have seen it on the SCAPL list, the Santa Cruz, another one of those lists that goes around, and it's not really terribly relevant because I haven't heard they're doing anything, so why should I bother about that? Steve Plaich's number, by the way, for those who want to check him out, he's he talks real fast, but he'll slow down for you. And he also is accessible, more so than almost any, I would have to say, than any city council candidate I've ever heard of, including myself when I was a write-in candidate in 2005 for a brief period of time in what was more of a comic episode than anything else. His number is 466-6078, 466-6078. There have recently been complaints out at the Homeless Lack of Services Center of disabled people being discriminated against. I encourage folks to get together out there, continue, call up, see what old Steve has to say about it. He's already gotten a call or two. I never quite know whatever happens with all these calls, but Steve does tend to show up at all the meetings, or many of them, so that's probably a good sign. He also calls into the station, and we have a great time bantering back and forth. So I think what I'm going to do now is roll into Scott Horton interviewing Glenn Greenwald around the National Defense Authorization Act's the overturning of the indefinite detention provision by that heroine of a judge. I don't really have much positive to say about judges, but that's Catherine Forrest, federal judge in New York, said, you can't detain people without charges, and that's unconstitutional. You know, the emperor has no clothes, in spite of the blather of the Obamatoids, the Obaminoids, the Abominables, who are supporting this shit, and saying, anybody but Romney, as though that was going to, you know, do anything worth a damn as the Constitution sinks into the swamp. Or crackles into the fire. I'm not sure what the story, the proper metaphor is. Anyway, let's hear a little of that. And after that, we're going to hear some making contact, assuming I can download something. And following that, Law and Disorder a bit down the pike, although I don't see our schedule posted here. Too bad. There may be some actual new broadcasters coming in this afternoon. And this evening there, I believe, is the People's Radio at 6, which used to have a lot of stuff on Occupy with Jackie, but I don't know if it still does. On Tuesday evening, you're going to get more of the kind of stuff I talk about sometimes with Coral and Free. Recommend you listen to them. And I'll be back on Thursday evening at 6, probably, unless I know learn better, as I always say. Also, Wednesday is the HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom meeting. That takes place every Wednesday at 10 o'clock in the morning at the Sub Rosa Cafe. So let's turn now to a more professional outfit than me, which might be worth a hoot, and listen to them. And if you want to catch me at 423-4833, if you can, 423-HUFF, off air.